In many ways, modern man, Homo sapiens, is a stranger to Earth. Ever since Charles Darwin shocked the scholars and theologians of his time with the evidence of evolution, life on Earth has been traced through man and the primates, mammals, and vertebrates, and backward through ever lower life forms to the point billions of years ago at which life is presumed to have begun. But having reached these beginnings and having begun to contemplate the probabilities of life elsewhere in our solar system and beyond, the scholars have become uneasy about life on Earth. Somehow it doesn't belong here. If it began through a series of spontaneous chemical reactions, why does life on Earth have but a single source and not a multitude of chance sources? And why does all living matter on Earth contain too little of the chemical elements that abound on Earth and too much of those that are rare on our planet? Was life, then, imported to Earth from elsewhere? Man's position in this evolutionary chain has compounded the puzzle. Finding a broken skull here, a jaw there, scholars at first believed that man originated in Asia some half million years ago. But as older fossils were found, it became evident that the mills of evolution grind much, much slower. Man's ancestor apes are now placed at a staggering 25 million years ago. Discoveries in East Africa reveal a transition to man-like apes some 14 million years ago. It was about 11 million years later that the first ape man worthy of classification Homo appeared there. The first being considered to be truly manlike existed in the same part of Africa some 2 million years ago. It took yet another million years to produce Homo erectus. Finally, another 900,000 years for the first primitive man to appear. He is named Neanderthal after the site where his remains were first found. In spite of the passage of more than 2 million years between advanced Australopithecus and Neanderthal, the tools of the two groups, sharp stones, were virtually alike, and the groups themselves were hardly distinguishable. Then suddenly and inexplicably, some 35,000 years ago, Homo sapiens appeared as if from nowhere and swept Neanderthal man from the face of Earth. These modern men, named Cro-Magnon, look so much like us that if dressed like us in modern clothes, they would be lost in the crowds of any European or American city. Because of the magnificent cave art which they created, they were at first called cavemen. In fact, they roamed the earth freely, for they knew how to build shelters and homes of stone and animal skins wherever they went. For millions of years, man's tools had been simple stones of useful shapes. Cro-Magnon man, however, made specialized tools and weapons of wood and bones. He was no longer a naked ape, or used skins for clothing. His society was organized. He lived in clans with a patriarchal hegemony. His cave drawings bespeak artistry and depth of feeling. His drawings and sculptures evidence some form of religion, apparent in the worship of a mother goddess, who was sometimes depicted with the sign of the moon's crescent. He buried his dead, and must therefore have had some philosophies regarding life, death, and perhaps even an afterlife. As mysterious and unexplained as the appearance of Cro-Magnon man has been, the puzzle is still more complicated, for as other remains of modern man were discovered, it became apparent that Cro-Magnon man stemmed from an even earlier Homo sapiens who lived in Western Asia and North Africa some 250,000 years before Cro-Magnon man. The appearance of modern man a mere 700,000 years before Homo erectus and some 200,000 years before Neanderthal man is absolutely implausible. It is also clear that Homo sapiens represent such an extreme departure from the slow evolutionary processes that many of our features, such as our ability to speak, are totally unrelated to earlier primates. An outstanding authority in the subject, Professor Theodosius Dubzhansky, was especially puzzled by the fact that this development took place during a period when Earth was going through an ice age, a most unpropitious time for evolutionary advance. Pointing out that Homo sapiens lacks completely some of the peculiarities of the previously known types and has some that never appeared before, he concluded, "Modern man has many fossil collateral relatives, but no progenitors. The derivation of Homo sapiens, then, becomes a puzzle." How, then, did the ancestors of modern man appear some 300,000 years ago instead of 2 million or 3 million years in the future following further evolutionary development? Were we imported to Earth from elsewhere? Or were we, as the Old Testament and other ancient sources claim, created by the gods? We now know where civilization began and how it developed once it began. The unanswered question is, why? Why did civilization come about at all? For as most scholars now admit in frustration, by all data, man should still be without civilization. There's no obvious reason that we should be any more civilized than the primitive tribes of the Amazon jungles or the inaccessible parts of New Guinea. But we are told these tribesmen still live as if in the Stone Age because they've all been isolated. But isolated from what? If they've been living on the same earth as we, why have they not acquired the same knowledge of sciences and technologies on their own as we supposedly have? The real puzzle, however, is not the backwardness of the Bushmen, but our advancement, for it's now recognized that in the normal course of evolution, man should still be typified by the Bushmen, and not by us. It took man some 2 million years to advance in his tool industries from the use of stones as he found them to the realization that he could chip and shape stones to better suit his purposes. Why not another 2 million years to learn to use other materials and another 10 million years to master mathematics and engineering and astronomy? Yet here we are, less than 50,000 years from Neanderthal man landing astronauts on the moon. The obvious question then is this: did we and our Mediterranean ancestors really acquire this advanced civilization on our own? Though Cro-Magnon man did not build skyscrapers nor use metals, there is no doubt that his was a sudden and revolutionary civilization. His mobility, ability to build shelters, his desire to clothe himself, his manufactured tools, his art, were all sudden high civilization, breaking an endless beginning of man's culture that stretched over millions of years and advanced at a painfully slow pace. Though our scholars cannot explain the appearance of Homo sapiens and the civilization of Cro-Magnon man, there is by now no doubt regarding the civilization's place of origin, the Near East. The uplands and mountain ranges that extend in a semi-arc from the Sargos Mountains in the east, where present-day Iran and Iraq border each other, through Ararat and Taurus ranges in the north, then down, westward and southward, to the hill lands of Syria, Lebanon, and Israel, are replete with caves where the evidence of prehistoric but modern man have been preserved. One of these caves, Shanidar, is located in the northeastern part of the semi-arc of civilization. Nowadays, fierce Kurdish tribesmen seek shelter in the area's caves for themselves and their flocks during the cold winter months. So it was one wintry night 44,000 years ago when a family of 7 sought shelter in the cave at Shanidar. Their remains? They were evidently crushed to death by a rock fall we discovered in 1957 by a startled Ralph Solecki, who went to the area in search of evidence of early man. What he found was more than he expected. As layer upon layer of debris was removed, it became apparent that the cave preserved a clear record of man's habitation in the area from about 100,000 to some 13,000 years ago. What this record showed was as surprising as the find itself. Man's culture has shown not a progression, but a regression. Starting from a certain standard, the following generation showed not more advanced, but less advanced standards of civilized life. And from about 27,000 B.C. to 11,000 B.C., the regressing and dwindling population reached the point of an almost complete absence of habitation. For reasons that are assumed to have been climatic, man was almost completely gone from the whole area for some 16,000 years. And then around 11,000 B.C., thinking man reappeared with new vigor and on an inexplicably higher cultural level. It was as if an unseen coach, watching the faltering human game, dispatched to the field a fresh and better trained team to take over from the exhausted one. Throughout the many millions of years of his endless beginning, man was nature's child. He subsisted by gathering foods that grew wild, by hunting the wild animals, by catching wild birds and fishes. But just as man's settlements were thinning out, just as he was abandoning his abodes, when his material and artistic achievements were disappearing, just then, suddenly, with no apparent reason, and without any prior known period of gradual preparation, man became a farmer. Agriculture began exactly where thinking man had emerged earlier with his first crude civilization, in the Near East. Man's first farming venture was the cultivation of wheat and barley. However, scholars remain baffled by the profusion of other plants and cereals basic to human survival and the advancement that kept coming out of the Near East. These included, in rapid succession, millet, rye, and spelt. Among the edible cereals, flax, which provided fibers and edible oil, and a variety of fruit-bearing shrubs and trees. In every instance, the plant was undoubtedly domesticated in the Near East for millennia before it reached Europe. It was as though the Near East was some kind of a genetic botanical laboratory, guided by an unseen hand. The general location of Eden was certainly known to the biblical generations. It was east of the land of Israel, in a land watered by four major rivers, two of which are the Tigris and the Euphrates. The Bible, like the scholars, places the start of vine cultivations in the mountains of northern Mesopotamia. Apples, pears, olives, figs, almonds, pistachios, walnuts, all originated in the Near East and spread from there to other parts of the world. We cannot help recalling that the Old Testament preceded our scholars in identifying the very same area as the world's first orchard, the Garden of Eden. The book of Genesis located the first orchard in northeastern Mesopotamia. Bible and science are in full agreement. Science tells us that the process went from wild grasses to wild cereals to cultivated cereals, followed by fruit-bearing shrubs and trees. This is exactly the process detailed in the first chapter of the book of Genesis. And the Lord said, "Let the earth bring forth grasses, cereals that by seeds produce seeds, fruit trees that bear fruit by species, which contain the seeds within themselves." And it was so. From an overall point of view, it would be appropriate to call the age that began about 11,000 B.C. not the Middle Stone Age, but the Age of Domestication. Within the span of a mere 3,600 years, man became a farmer, and wild plants and animals were domesticated. Then a new age clearly followed with the appearance of pottery, for reasons that still elude our scholars. But which will become clear as we unfold our tale of prehistoric events here, man's march towards civilization was confined to the highlands of the Near East. The discovery of the many uses to which clay could be put was contemporary with man's descent from his mountain abodes. By the 7th millennium B.C., the Near Eastern arc of civilization was teeming with clay or pottery cultures. But once again, progress slowed, and by 4500 B.C., archaeological evidence indicates regression was all around. Pottery became simpler. Stone utensils, a relic of the Stone Age, again became predominant. Inhabited sites reveal fewer remains. Some sites that had been centers of pottery and clay industries began to be abandoned, and distinct clay manufacturing disappeared. Man and his culture were clearly on the decline. Then suddenly, unexpectedly, inexplicably, the Near East witnessed the blossoming of the greatest civilization imaginable, a civilization in which our own is firmly rooted. A mysterious hand once more picked man out of his decline and raised him to an even higher level of culture, knowledge, and civilization. For a long time, Western man believed that his civilization was the gift of Rome and Greece. But the Greek philosophers themselves wrote repeatedly that they had drawn on even earlier sources. The decipherment of the ancient Egyptian script and language, and the archaeological efforts that followed, revealed to Western man that a high civilization had existed in Egypt well before the advent of the Greek civilization. Was the origin of our civilization then in Egypt? Well, as logical as that conclusion would have seemed, the facts militated against it. Greek scholars did describe visits to Egypt, but the ancient sources of knowledge of which they spoke were found elsewhere. The pre-Hellenic cultures of the Aegean Sea, the Minoan on the island of Crete, and the Mycenaean on the Greek mainland, revealed evidence that the Near Eastern, not the Egyptian, culture had been adopted. Syria and Anatolia, not Egypt, were the principal avenues through which an earlier civilization became available to the Greeks. Scholars have been fascinated to discover a growing number of similarities between the Semitic and Hellenic civilizations. Professor Cyrus H. Gordon opened up a new field of study by showing that an earlier Minoan script, called Linear A, represented a Semitic language. He concluded that the pattern of the Hebrew in Minoan civilizations is the same to a remarkable extent. Even the Hellenic alphabet, from which the Latin and our own alphabets derive, came from the Near East. The scholars were aware, of course, of Greek contacts with the Near East in the first millennium B.C., culminating with the defeat of the Persians by Alexander the Macedonian in 331 B.C. Greek records contain much information about these Persians and their lands. It has been established by now that the cultural, religious, and historic roots of these old Persians go back to the earlier empires of Babylon and Assyria, whose extent and fall is recorded in the Old Testament. Many of the world's museums count among their prize exhibits their ceremonial gates, winged bulls, bas-reliefs, chariots, tools, utensils, jewelry, statues, and other objects made of every conceivable material that have been dug out of the mounds of Assyria and Babylonia. But the true treasures of these kingdoms were their written records, thousands upon thousands of inscriptions in the cuneiform script, including cosmologic tales, epic poems, histories of kings, temple records, commercial contracts, marriage and divorce records, astronomical tables, astrological forecasts, mathematical formulas, geographic lists, grammar and vocabulary school text, and not least of all, texts dealing with the names, genealogies, deeds, powers, and duties of the gods. The common language that formed the cultural, historical, and religious bond between Assyria and Babylonia was Akkadian. It was the first known Semitic language. But the Assyrians and Babylonians laid no claim to having invented the language or its scripts. Indeed, many of their tablets bore the postscript that they had been copied from earlier originals. Who then invented the cuneiform script and developed the language, its precise grammar, and its rich vocabulary? Who wrote those earlier originals? And why did the Assyrians and Babylonians call the language Akkadian? Attention once more focuses on the book of Genesis and the beginning of his kingdom, Babel and Erech and Akkad. The ruins of Mesopotamia have provided conclusive evidence that once upon a time there indeed existed a kingdom by the name of Akkad, established by a much earlier ruler who called himself Asherakan, righteous ruler. He claimed in his inscriptions that his empire stretched by the grace of the god Enlil from the lower sea, the Persian Gulf, to the upper sea, believed to be the Mediterranean. The scholars stood awed. They had come upon a Mesopotamian empire in the 3rd millennium B.C. There was a leap backward of some 2,000 years from the Assyrian Sargon of Dur, Sharakan, to Sargon of Akkad. And yet the mounds that were dug up brought to light literature and art, science and politics, commerce and communications, a full-fledged civilization long before the appearance of Babylonia or Assyria. Moreover, it was obviously the predecessor and the source of the later civilizations. Assyria and Babylonia were only branches off the Akkadian trunk. It also appeared certain that there must have been kingdoms and cities and civilizations in Mesopotamia even before the 3rd millennium B.C., The only question was, how far back did one have to go to find the first civilized kingdom? The key that unlocked the puzzle was yet another language. Scholars took another look at the Akkadian inscriptions. Basically, the cuneiform script was syllabic. Each sign stood for a complete syllable. Yet the script made extensive use of signs that were not phonetic syllables, but conveyed the meaning god, city, country, and the like. The only possible explanation for this phenomenon was that these signs were remains of an earlier writing method which used pictographs. Akkadian, then, must have been preceded by another language that used a writing method akin to the Egyptian hieroglyphs. It was soon obvious that an earlier language, and not just an earlier form of writing, was involved here. Scholars found that inscriptions and texts made extensive use of loan words, words borrowed intact from another language, in the same way that modern Frenchmen would borrow the English word weekend. Now, this was especially true where scientific or technical terminology was involved, and also in matters dealing with the gods and the heavens. In January 1869, Jules Ott suggested to the French Society of Numismatics and Archaeology that recognition be given to the existence of a pre-Akkadian language and people, pointing out that the early rulers of Mesopotamia proclaimed their legitimacy by taking the title King of Sumer and Akkad. He suggested that the people be called Sumerians and their land Sumer. Once the scholars had accepted these conclusions, the floodgates were opened. The decipherment of the Sumerian language and script, and the realization that the Sumerians and their culture were the fountainhead of all Akkadian, Babylonian, and Assyrian achievements, spurred archaeological searches in southern Mesopotamia. All of the evidence now indicated that the beginning was there. The first significant excavation of the Sumerian site was begun in 1877 by French archaeologists, and the finds from this single site were so extensive that others continued to dig there until 1933 without completing the job. The site proved to be an early Sumerian city, indeed a royal city. The dynasty had started around 2900 BC and lasted nearly 650 years. During this time, 43 Enses reigned without interruption at Lagash, Their names, genealogies, and links of rule were all neatly recorded. One of the better-known rulers of Lagash was Gudea. He had a large number of statues made of himself, all showing him in a votive stance, praying to his gods. This stance was no pretense. Gudea had indeed devoted himself to the adoration of Nengirsu, his principal deity, and the construction and rebuilding of temples. His many inscriptions reveal that in the search for exquisite building material, he obtained gold from Africa and Anatolia, silver from the Taurus Mountains, cedars from Lebanon, other rare woods from Ararat, copper from the Zagros Range, diorite from Egypt, carnelian from Ethiopia, and other materials from lands yet unidentified by scholars. When Moses built for the Lord God a residence in the desert, he did so according to very detailed instructions provided by the Lord. 1,200 years before Moses, Gudea made the same claim. The instructions he recorded in one very long inscription were given him in a vision. A man that shone like the heaven, by whose side stood a divine bird, commanded me to build his temple. This man, who from the crown on his head was obviously a god, was later identified as the god Nengirsu. With him was a goddess who held a tablet of her favorite star of the heavens. Her other hand held a holy stylus, with which she indicated to Gudea the favorable planet. A third man, also a god, held in his hand a tablet of precious stone, the plan of the temple it contained. One of Gudea's statues shows him seated, with this tablet on his knees. On the tablet, the divine drawing can clearly be seen. Wise as he was, Gudea was baffled by these architectural instructions, and he sought the advice of a goddess who could interpret divine messages. She explained to him the meaning of the instructions, the plan's measurements, and the size and shape of the bricks to be used. Gudea then employed a male diviner, maker of decisions, and a female searcher of secrets to locate the site on the city's outskirts, where the god wished his temple to be built. He then recruited 216,000 people for the construction job. Gudea's bafflement can readily be understood, for the simple-looking floor plan supposedly gave him the necessary information to build a complex ziggurat, rising high by 7 stages. The divine architects, it appears, were able to provide with a single floor plan, accompanied by 7 varying scales, the complete instructions for the construction of a 7-stage high-rise temple. It's been said that war spurs man to scientific and material breakthroughs. In ancient Sumer, it seems, temple construction spurred the people and their rulers into greater technological achievements. The ability to carry out major construction work according to prepared architectural plans, to organize and feed a huge labor force, to flatten lands and raise mounds, to mold bricks and transport stones, to bring rare metal and other materials from afar, to cast metal and shape utensils and ornaments, all clearly speak of a high civilization already in full bloom in the 3rd millennium B.C. As masterful as even the earliest Sumerian temples were, they represented but the tip of an iceberg of the scope and richness of the material achievements of the first great civilization known to man. In addition to the invention and development of writing, the Sumerians should be credited with the invention of printing. Millennia before Johann Gutenberg invented printing by using movable type, Sumerian scribes used ready-made type of the various pictographic signs which they used as we now use rubber stamps to impress the desired sequence of signs in the wet clay. They also invented the forerunner of our rotary presses, the cylinder seal. Made of extremely hard stone, it was a small cylinder into which the message or design had been engraved in reverse. Whenever the seal was rolled on wet clay, the imprint created a positive impression. No high civilization would have been possible without a parallel advanced system of mathematics. The Sumerian system, called sexagesimal, combined a mundane 10 with a celestial 6 to obtain a base figure 60. It enables the Sumerians to divide into fractions and multiply into millions. The 360-degree circle, the foot, and its 12 inches are but a few of the examples of the vestiges of Sumerian mathematics still evident in our daily life. The many varieties of metals and alloys for which Sumerian and Akkadian names have been found and the extensive technological terminology attest to the high level of metallurgy in ancient Mesopotamia. The Sumerian use of petroleum products was also basic to the advanced chemistry. Sick persons in Sumerian times could choose between an Azu, that's a water physician, or an Iazu, oil physician. Sumerian medical tests deal with diagnosis and prescriptions. One of Sumer's earliest material achievements was the development of textile and clothing industries. Another major Sumerian achievement was its agriculture. The Sumerians used their two great rivers as an artificial network of canals for waterborne transportation of people, goods, and cattle. In 1956, Professor Samuel M. Kramer, one of the great Sumerologists of our time, reviewed the literary legacy found beneath the mounds of Sumer. The table of contents of From the Tablets of Sumer is a gem in itself, for each one of the 25 chapters described a Sumerian first, including the first schools, the first bicameral Congress, the first historian, the first pharmacopoeia, the first farmer's almanac, the first cosmogony, the first cosmology, the first Job, the first Proverbs and Sayings, the first literary debates, the first Noah, the first library catalog, and man's first heroic age, his first law codes and social reforms, his first medicine, agriculture, and search for world peace and harmony. This is no exaggeration. The first schools were established in Sumer as a direct outgrowth of the invention and introduction of writing. As Sumer's civilization was uncovered, it became clear that the first for a system of laws, for concepts of social order, and for fair administration of justice belonged to Sumer. While the Babylonians made rules and regulations, the Sumerians were concerned with justice, for they believed that the gods appointed the kings primarily to assure justice in the land. The Sumerian concern with justice, or its absence, also found expression in what Professor Kramer called the first Job. Matching together fragments of clay tablets at the Istanbul Museum of Antiquities, Kramer was able to read a good part of a Sumerian poem which, like the biblical book of Job, dealt with the complaint of a righteous man who, instead of being blessed by the gods, was made to suffer all manner of loss and disrespect. "My righteous word has been turned into a lie," he cried out in anguish. In its second part, the anonymous sufferer petitions his God in a manner akin to some of the verses in the Hebrew Psalms. "My God, you who are my father, who beget me, lift up my face. How long will you neglect me, leave me unprotected, leave me without guidance?" Then follows a happy ending. The righteous words, the pure words uttered by him, his God accepted. His God withdrew his hand from the evil pronouncement. The material and spiritual achievements of the Sumerian civilization were also accompanied by an extensive development of the performing arts. A team of scholars from the University of California at Berkeley made news in March 1974 when they announced that they had deciphered the world's oldest song. "We always knew," the Berkeley team explained, "that there was music in the earlier Assyrio-Babylonian civilization, but until this deciphering, we didn't know that it was the same heptatonic-diatonic scale that is characteristic of contemporary Western music and of Greek music of the first millennium B.C. Until now, it was thought that Western music originated in Greece. Now it's been established that our music, as so much else of Western civilization, originated in Mesopotamia." After excavating at Lagash, the archaeologist Spade uncovered Nippur, the one-time religious center of Sumer and Akkad. At Shuruppak, schoolhouses dating to the 3rd millennium B.C. were found. At Ur, scholars found magnificent vases, jewelry, weapons, chariots, helmets made of gold, silver, copper, and bronze, the remains of a weaving factory, and a towering ziggurat. At Kish, monumental buildings and a ziggurat from at least 3000 B.C. were unearthed. Uruk took the archaeologists back into the 4th millennium B.C. Further south, archaeologists found Urdu, the first Sumerian city. When the spades came upon the foundations of the first temple, below that was virgin soil. The time was about 3800 B.C. That is when civilization began. Having begun to use the stones as tools some 2 million years earlier, man achieved this unprecedented civilization in about 3800 B.C. And the perplexing fact about this is that to this very day, the scholars have no inkling who the Sumerians were and how and why their civilization appeared. Joseph Campbell summed it up this way: "With stunning abruptness, there appears in this little Sumerian mud garden the whole cultural syndrome that has since constituted the germinal unit of all the high civilizations of the world." What was it that after hundreds of thousands and even millions of years of painfully slow human development abruptly changed everything so completely? One can go further and ask even more: why did it happen at all? The Sumerians, the people through whom this high civilization so suddenly came into being, had a ready answer. It was summed up by one of the tens of thousands of ancient Mesopotamian inscriptions that have been uncovered. Whatever seems beautiful, we made by the grace of the gods. The gods of Sumer. Who were they? Were the gods of the Sumerians like the Greek gods, who were described as living in a great court, feasting in the great hall of Zeus in the heavens, Olympus, whose counterpart on earth was Greece's highest peak, Mount Olympus? The Greeks described their gods as anthropomorphic, as physically similar to mortal man and woman, and human in character. They could be happy and angry and jealous. They made love, quarreled, fought. They even procreated like humans, bringing forth offspring through sexual intercourse with each other or with humans. They were unreachable, and yet they were constantly mixed up in human affairs. They could travel at immense speeds, appear and disappear. They had weapons of immense and unusual power. Each had specific functions, and as a result, a specific human activity could suffer or benefit by the attitude of the god in charge of that particular activity. Therefore, rituals of worship and offerings to the gods were supposed to gain their favor. But their total number, 12, could not be exceeded. It appears that the number 12 was a requirement. Though Greek mythology was not clear regarding the origins of mankind, the legends and traditions claim descent from the gods for heroes and kings. These semigods form the link between the human destiny, daily toil, dependence on the elements, plagues, illness, death, and a golden past, when only the gods roamed the earth. And although so many of the gods were born on earth, the select circle of 12 Olympians represented the celestial aspect of the gods. The original Olympus was described by the Odyssey as laying in the pure upper air. The original 12 great gods were gods of heaven, who had come down to earth, and they represented the 12 celestial bodies in the vault of heaven. The Latin names of the Greek gods given them when the Romans adopted the Greek pantheon clarify their astral association. Gaia was earth, Hermes, Mercury, Aphrodite, Venus, Ares, Mars, Cronus, Saturn, and Zeus, Jupiter. Continuing the Greek tradition, the Romans envisioned Jupiter as a thundering god whose weapon was the lightning bolt. Like the Greeks, the Romans associated him with the bull. There is now general agreement that the foundations of the distinct Greek civilization were laid on the island of Crete, where the Minoan culture flourished from about 2700 BC to 1400 BC. The Greeks, in fact, never claimed that their Olympian gods came directly to Greece from the heavens. Zeus arrived from across the Mediterranean via Crete. Aphrodite was said to have come by sea from the Near East. Poseidon, Neptune to the Romans, brought the horse with him from Asia Minor. Athena brought the olive, fertile and self-sown, to Greece from the lands of the Bible. There is no doubt that the Greek traditions and religion arrived on the Greek mainland from the Near East via Asia Minor and the Mediterranean islands. It is there that the pantheon had its roots. It is there that we should look for the origin of the Greek gods and their astral relationship with the number 12. Hinduism, the ancient religion of India, considers the Vedas, compositions of hymns, sacrificial formulas, and other sayings pertaining to the gods, as sacred scriptures, not of human origin. The gods themselves composed them, the Hindu tradition says, in the age that preceded the present one. But as time went on, more and more of the original 100,000 verses passed from generation to generation orally were lost and confused. In the end, a sage wrote down the remaining verses, divided them into four books, and trusting four of his principal disciples to preserve one Veda each. When in the 19th century scholars began to decipher and understand forgotten languages and trace the connections between them, they realized that the Vedas were written in a very ancient Indo-European language, the predecessor of the Indian root tongue Sanskrit, of Greek, Latin, and other European languages. When they were finally able to read and analyze the Vedas, they were surprised to see the uncanny similarity between Vedic tales of the gods and the Greek ones. The tales concerning the principal deities, as well as verses dealing with a multitude of other lesser deities, are clearly related to the Greek tales. And in both instances, the circle of the great gods always stood at 12, no matter what changes took place in the divine succession. How could such similarity arise in two areas so far apart, geographically and in time? Scholars believe that sometime in the second millennium BC, a people speaking an Indo-European language and centered in northern Iran, or the Caucasus area, embarked on great migrations. One group went southeast to India. The Hindus call them the Aryans, noble men. They brought with them the Vedas, or oral tales, about 1500 B.C. Another wave of this Indo-European migration went westward to Europe. Some circled the Black Sea and arrived in Europe via the steppes of Russia. But the main route by which these people and their traditions and religion reached Greece was the shortest one, Asia Minor. Some of the most ancient Greek cities, in fact, lie not in the Greek mainland, but in the western tip of Asia Minor. But who were these Indo-Europeans who chose Anatolia as their abode? Little in Western knowledge shed light on that subject once again. The only readily available and reliable source proved to be the Old Testament. There, the scholars found several references to the Hittites as the people inhabiting the mountains of Anatolia. Forearmed with clues provided in Egyptian and Mesopotamian texts, the scholars embarked on excavations of ancient sites in Anatolia's hilly regions. The efforts paid off. They found Hittite cities, palaces, royal treasures, royal tombs, temples, religious objects, tools, weapons, art objects. Above all, they found many inscriptions. The biblical Hittites had come to life. A unique monument bequeathed to us by the ancient Near East is a rock carving outside the ancient Hittite capital on which all of the gods of the Hittites were depicted in procession. Marching in from left in a long procession of primarily male deities clearly organized in companies of 12. Much effort was invested by scholars to determine the names, titles, and roles of the deities included in the procession. But it's clear that the Hittite pantheon, too, was governed by the Olympian 12. The lesser gods were organized in groups of 12, and the great gods on earth were associated with 12 celestial bodies. The archaeological finds showed conclusively that the Hittites worshipped gods that were of heaven and earth, all interrelated and arranged in a genealogical hierarchy. Some were great or olden gods who were originally of the heavens. Other gods were actually present, not merely on earth, but among the Hittites, acting as supreme rulers of the land. A long and well-preserved Hittite epic tale entitled Kingship in Heaven deals with the heavenly origin of the gods, thus establishing that the gods of old were both of heaven and upon earth. The epic lists the 12 mighty olden ones, the forebearers of the gods, and proceeds to tell how the god who was king in heaven came to dark-hued earth. A god named Alalu was forcefully deposed from his throne somewhere in the heavens and, fleeing for his life, descended to earth. But that was not the end. The text proceeded to recount how Anu, in turn, was also deposed by a god named Kumarbi, Anu's own brother, by some interpretations. There's no doubt that this epic, written 1,000 years before the Greek legends were composed, was the forerunner of the tale of the deposing of Uranus by Cronus and Cronus by Zeus. Even the detail pertaining to the castration of Cronus by Zeus is found in the Hittite text, for that was exactly what Kumarbi did to Anu. Though emasculated, Anu managed to fly back to his heavenly abode, leaving Kumarbi in control of earth. Meanwhile, Anu's manhood produced several deities within Kumarbi's insides, which he, like Cronus of the Greek legends, was forced to release. One of these was Teshub, the chief Hittite deity. However, there was to be one more epic battle before Teshub could rule in peace. Did the particular battles fought by Teshub upon earth and in the skies take place when the age of Taurus commenced around 4000 B.C.? Was it for that reason that the winner was granted association with the bull? And were the events in any way connected with the beginning, at the very same time, of the sudden civilization in Sumer? There could be no doubt that the Hittite pantheon and tales of the gods indeed had their roots in Sumer, its civilization, and its gods. The tale of the challenge to the divine throne continues to relate heroic battles, but of an inconclusive nature. At one point, the failure of Teshub to defeat his adversary even caused his spouse to attempt suicide. Finally, an appeal was made to the gods to mediate the dispute, and an assembly of the gods was called. It was led by an olden god named Enlil, and another olden god named Ea, who was called upon to produce the old tablets with the words of destiny, some ancient records that could apparently help settle the dispute regarding the divine succession. Who were these olden gods? All of them bear Sumerian names. Even the name Teshub, as well as the names of other Hittite gods, were often written in Sumerian script to denote their identities. Also, some of the places named in the action were those of ancient Sumerian sites. It dawned on the scholars that the Hittites, in fact, worshipped a pantheon of Sumerian origins. Now, when the Hittites reached Babylon sometime after 1600 BC, the Sumerians were already long gone from the Near Eastern scene. How was it then that their language, literature, and religion dominated another great kingdom in another millennium and in another part of Asia? The bridge scholars have recently discovered were a people called Hurrians, referred to in the Old Testament as Horites, meaning free people. They dominated the wide area between Sumer and Akkad in Mesopotamia and the Hittite kingdom in Anatolia. Egyptian and Mesopotamian royal documents referred to the Hurrian kingdom as Mitanni and dealt with it on an equal footing, a strong power whose influence spread beyond its immediate borders. The Hittites called their Hurrian neighbors Hurri. These Hurrians dominated the Hittites culturally and religiously. The Hittites acquired their cosmology, their myths, their gods, and their pantheon of 12 from the Hurrians. Since the culture and religion were only a development of the original Sumerian traditions and beliefs, the Hurrians, in fact, absorbed and transmitted the religion of Sumer. The epic tales, it has become clear, were the tales of Sumer, the dwelling place of the olden gods, where Sumerian cities, the olden language, was the language of Sumer. Even the Hurrian art duplicated Sumerian art, its form, its themes, and its symbols. Evidence suggests that the Hurrians, who were the northern neighbors of Sumer and Akkad in the second millennium B.C., had actually commingled with Sumerians in the previous millennium. In the 13th century B.C., under the pressure of vast migrations and invasions, including the Israelite thrust from Egypt to Canaan, the Hurrians retreated to the northeastern portion of their kingdom. There, they worshipped a pantheon headed by Teshub, depicting him as a vigorous god wearing a horned cap and standing upon his cult symbol, the bull. What about the other avenue by which the tales and worship of gods reached Greece, from the eastern shores of the Mediterranean via Crete and Cyprus? The lands that are today Israel, Lebanon, and southern Syria, which formed the southwestern band of the ancient Fertile Crescent, were then the habitat of people that can be grouped together as Canaanites. The Canaanite language was what scholars call West Semitic, a branch of a group of languages which also includes the earliest Akkadian and present-day Hebrew. The language, literary style, and terminology are reminiscent of the Old Testament. The pantheon that unfolds from the Canaanite text bears many similarities to the later Greek one. Whence had the Canaanites, for their part, drawn their culture and religion? Well, the Old Testament considered them a part of the Hamitic family of nations with roots in the hot lands of Africa, brothers of the Egyptians. The artifacts and written records unearthed by archaeologists confirm the close affinity between the two, as well as the many similarities between the Canaanite and Egyptian deities. The many national and local gods, the multitude of their names and epithets, the diversity of their roles, emblems, and animal mascots, at first cast the gods of Egypt as an unfathomable crowd of actors upon a strange stage. But a closer look reveals that they were essentially no different from those in the other lands of the ancient world. The Egyptians believed in gods of heaven and earth, great gods that were clearly distinguished from the multitude of lesser deities. G.A. Wainwright summed up the evidence showing that the Egyptian belief in gods of heaven who descended to earth from the skies was extremely ancient. The Egyptian word for divine being or god was Enter, which means one who watches. Significantly, that is exactly the meaning of the name Sumer, the land of the ones who watch. The earlier notion that civilization may have begun in Egypt has been discarded by now. There's ample evidence showing that the Egyptian organized society and civilization, which began half a millennium and more after the Sumerian one, drew its culture, architecture, technology, art of writing, and the many other aspects of a high civilization from Sumer. The weight of evidence also shows that the gods of Egypt originated in Sumer. Cultural and blood kinsmen of the Egyptians, the Canaanites shared the same gods with them, but situated in a land strip that was a bridge between Asia and Africa from time immemorial, the Canaanites also came under strong Semitic and Mesopotamian influences. Like the Hittites to the north, the Hurrians to the northeast, the Egyptians to the south, the Canaanites could not boast of an original pantheon. They too acquired their cosmogony, their deities, their legendary tales from elsewhere. Their direct contacts with the Sumerian sources were the Amorites. The lands of the Amorites lay between Mesopotamia and the Mediterranean lands of Western Asia. In the 1930s, archaeologists came upon the center and capital city of the Amorites known as Mari, At a bend of the Euphrates, where the Syrian border now cuts the river, the diggers uncovered a major city whose buildings were erected and continuously re-erected between 2000 and 2000 BC on foundations that date to centuries earlier. These earliest remains included a step pyramid and temples of the Sumerian deities. The palace of Mar-a-Lon occupied some 5 acres and included a throne room painted with the most striking murals, 300 various rooms, scribal chambers, and well over 20,000 tablets in the cuneiform script, dealing with the economy, trade, politics, and social life of those times, with state and military matters, and of course, with the religion of the land and its people. Among the finds at Mari, as elsewhere in the lands of Sumer, there were dozens of statues of the people themselves, kings, nobles, priests, singers. They were invariably depicted with their hands clasped in prayer, their gaze frozen forever toward their gods. Who were these gods of heaven and earth, divine yet human, always headed by a pantheon or inner circle of 12 deities? We have entered the temples of the Greeks and the Aryans, the Hittites and the Hurrians, the Canaanites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. We have followed paths that took us across continents and seas, and clues that carried us over several millennia. All of the corridors of all of the temples have led us to one source, Sumer. There were, the Sumerians believed, gods that were of the heavens. Texts dealing with the time before things were created talk of such heavenly gods. As we look closer at these gods, we shall realize that they were the celestial bodies that make up our solar system. There were also lesser gods that were of earth. Between the two groups, there were gods of heaven and earth, the ones called the ancient gods. They were the olden gods of the epic tales, and in the Sumerian belief, they had come down to earth from the heavens. These were no mere local deities. They were national gods, indeed international gods. Some of them were present and active upon the earth even before there were men upon the earth. Indeed, the very existence of man was deemed to have been the result of a deliberate, creative enterprise on the part of these gods. They were powerful, capable of feats beyond mortal ability and comprehension. Yet these gods not only looked like humans, but ate and drank like them and displayed virtually every human emotion of love and hate, loyalty and infidelity. The head of this family of gods of heaven and earth was An, or Anu in the Babylonian Assyrian text. He was the great father of the gods, the king of the gods. His symbol was a star. In the Sumerian pictographic writing, the sign of a star also stood for An, for heaven, and for divine being, or God. Anu's abode, and the seat of his kingdom, was in the heavens. That is where the other gods of heaven and earth went when they needed individual advice or favor, or where they met in assembly to settle disputes among themselves, or to reach major decisions. Numerous texts describe Anu's palace, whose portals were guarded by a god of the Tree of Truth, and a god of the Tree of Life. The Sumerian texts recall instances when not only the other gods, but even some chosen mortals were permitted to go up to Anu's abode, mostly with the object of escaping mortality. Now, one such tale pertained to Adapa, model of man. He was so perfect and so loyal to the god Ea, who had created him, that Ea arranged for him to be taken to Anu. The Sumerians claimed that not only gods, but also selected mortals could ascend to the divine abode in the heavens, and that's echoed in the New Testament tales of the ascents to the heavens by Enoch and the prophet Elijah. After Anu, the second most powerful deity of the Sumerian pantheon was Enlil. His name meant Lord of the Airspace, the prototype and father of the later storm gods that were to head the pantheons of the ancient world. He was Anu's eldest son, born at his father's heavenly abode, but at some point in the earliest times, he descended to earth and was thus the principal god of heaven and earth. Not only the Sumerians, but the very gods of Sumer considered Enlil supreme. They called him ruler of all the lands and made it clear that in heaven he is the prince, on earth he is the chief. Enlil, according to Sumerian beliefs, arrived on earth well before earth became settled and civilized. A hymn to Enlil recounts the many aspects of society and civilization that would not have existed had it not been for Enlil's instruction to execute his orders far and wide. A portion of the hymn reads like this. No cities would be built, no settlements founded, no stalls would be built, no sheepfolds erected, no king would be raised, no high priest born. The Sumerians revered Enlil out of both fear and gratitude. It was he who made sure that decrees by the assembly of the gods were carried out against mankind. It was his wind that blew obliterating storms against offending cities. It was he who, at the time of the deluge, sought the destruction of mankind. But when at peace with mankind, he was a friendly God who bestowed favors according to the Sumerian texts and knowledge of farming, together with the plow and the pickaxe, were granted to mankind by Enlil. Enlil also selected the kings who were to rule over mankind, not as sovereigns, but as servants of the God entrusted with the administration of divine laws of justice. Accordingly, Sumerian and Babylonian kings opened their inscriptions of self-adoration by describing how Enlil had called them to kingship. These calls, issued by Enlil on behalf of himself and his father Anu, granted legitimacy to the ruler and outlined his functions. Even Hammurabi, who acknowledged a god named Marduk as the national god of Babylon, prefaced his code of laws by stating that Anu and Enlil name me to promote the welfare of the people, to cause justice to prevail in the land. The third great god of Sumer was another son of Anu. He bore two names, Ea and Enki. Like his brother Enlil, he too was a god of heaven and earth, a deity originally of the heavens who had come down to earth. Ea, the name meant literally house water, was a master engineer, planned and supervised the construction of canals, the diking of rivers, and the draining of the marshlands. As lord of the seas, Ea built ships that sailed to far lands, and especially to places from which precious metals and semi-precious stone were brought to Sumer. Sumerian deluge text, on which the biblical account must have been drawn, depict Ea as the god who, in defiance of the decision of the assembly of gods, enabled a trusted follower, the Mesopotamian Noah, to escape the disaster. Indeed, the Sumerian text, which, like the Old Testament, adhered to the belief that a god or gods created man through a conscious and deliberate act, attribute to Ea a key role. As the chief scientist of the gods, he outlined the method and the process by which man was to be created. Was Ea on the side of man simply because he had a hand in his creation, or did he have other more subjective motives? Invariably, Ea's defiance, in mortal and divine matters alike, was aimed mostly at frustrating decisions or plans emanating from Enlil. Several biblical tales, of Eve and the serpent in the Garden of Eden, or of the tale of the deluge or the flood, involve in their original Sumerian versions instances of defiance by Ea and his brother's edicts. The reason is given by Enki himself in his autobiography. It was he, not Enlil, who was first born, Enki claimed. Enlil, the son of Anu and his official consort Antu, was the first legal first son. Enki was born first, but to a concubine. The biblical tale of Isaac and Ishmael may have had a prior parallel in the heavenly abode. Several Sumerian epic tales have been found about the arguments and even bloody struggles among the younger gods. Many cylinder seals depict scenes of gods battling gods. It would seem that the original rivalry between Enki and Enlil was carried on and intensified between their sons, with brothers sometimes turning against brother, a divine tale of Cain and Abel. At some point, Enki decided to put his efforts into making a son of his, the third generation successor. This he sought to achieve with the aid of his half-sister, Ninhursag. She, too, was of the heavens. She was the chief nurse, the one in charge of medical facilities. According to the Sumerian text, man was created by Ninhursag following processes and formulas devised by Enki. It was in that role that the goddess was called Ninti, Lady Life. The position of the sons of Anu, Enlil, and Enki, and of their offspring in the dynastic lineage, emerges clearly through a unique Sumerian device, the allocation of numerical rank to certain gods. There were many other gods in Sumer, children, grandchildren, nieces, and nephews of the great gods. There were also several hundred rank-and-file gods called Anunnaki, who were assigned general duties. But only 12 made the great circle. They included Anu, Enlil, and Enki, and spouses, and Ninhursag, Enlil's sons, Ninurta, Ishkur, and Nanner, and the latter's spouse, Ningal. They were joined by Nanner's twin children, Utu and Inanna, who replaced Ninhursag in old age. Sumerian text. Leave no doubt that the peoples of the ancient Near East were certain that the gods of heaven and earth were able to rise from earth and ascend into the heavens, as well as roam earth's skies at will. Such a capability was often indicated by the ancient artist by depicting the gods, anthropomorphic in all other respects, with wings. The wings, as can be seen from numerous depictions, were not a part of the body, not natural wings, but rather a decorative attachment to the god's clothing. Texts described how Inanna very meticulously put on herself seven objects prior to the start of a voyage. The shoe she put on her head, measuring pendants on her ears, chains of small blue stones around her neck, twin stones on her shoulders, a golden cylinder in her hands, straps clasping her breast, the pala garment clothed around her body. Though no one has yet been able to explain the nature and significance of these seven objects, we feel that the answer has long been available. Excavating the Assyrian capital Assur from 1903 to 1914, Walter Andre and his colleagues found in the temple of Ishtar a battered statue of the goddess, showing her with various contraptions attached to her chest and back. In 1934, archaeologists excavating the Mare came upon a similar but intact statue buried in the ground. Unlike the flat carvings or bas-relief, this life-size, three-dimensional representation of the goddess reveals interesting features. On her head, she wears a special helmet. Protruding from it on both sides and fitted over the ears are objects that remind one of a pilot's earphones. On her neck and upper chest, the goddess wears a necklace of many small and probably precious stones. In her hands, she holds a cylindrical object, which appears too thick and heavy to be a vase for holding water. Over a blouse of see-through material, two parallel straps run across her chest, leading back to and holding in place an unusual box of rectangular shape. The box is held tight against the back of the goddess's neck and is firmly attached to the helmet with a horizontal strap. Whatever the box held inside must have been heavy, for the contraption is further supported by two large shoulder pads. The weight of the box is increased by a hose that is connected to its base by a circular clasp. The complete package of instruments is held in place with the aid of two sets of straps that crisscross the goddess's back and chest. The parallel between the seven objects required by Inanna for her aerial journeys and the dress and objects worn by the statue from Mare is easily proved. We see that the measuring pendants, the earphones on her ears, the rows of chains of small stones around her neck, the twin stones, the two shoulder pads on her shoulders, the golden cylinder in her hands, and the clasping straps that crisscross her breast. She is indeed clothed in a pala garment or a ruler's garment, and on her head she wears the Shagara helmet, a term that literally means that which makes go far into the universe. All of this suggests to us that the attire of Inanna was that of an aeronaut or an astronaut. The Old Testament called the angels of the Lord Malachim, literally emissaries who carried divine messages and carried out divine commands. As so many instances reveal, they were divine airmen. Jacob saw them going up a skyladder. Hagar, Abraham's concubine, was addressed by them from the sky, and it was they who brought about the aerial destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Clay figurines found at Sumerian sites and believed to be some 5,500 years old may well be crude representation of such malachim holding wand-like weapons. In one instance, the face is seen through a helmet's visor. In the other instance, the emissary wears the distinct divine conical headdress and a uniform studded with circular objects of unknown function. The eye slots or goggles of the figurines are the most interesting feature because the Near East in the 4th millennium B.C. was literally swamped with wafer-like figurines that depicted in a stylized manner the upper part of the deities, exaggerating their most prominent feature, a conical helmet with elliptical visors or goggles. It is undoubtedly no mere coincidence that the Hittites, linked to Sumer and Akkad, adopted as their written sign for gods a symbol clearly borrowed from the eye figurines. It is also no wonder that this symbol or hieroglyph for divine being expressed in artistic styles came to dominate the art not only of Asia Minor, but also the early Greeks during the Minoan and Mycenaean periods. The Greek legend of Icarus had him attempt to fly by attaching feathered wings to his body with wax. The evidence from the ancient Near East shows that though the gods may have been depicted with wings to indicate their flying capabilities, or perhaps sometimes put on winged uniforms as a mark of their airmanship, they never attempted to use attached wings for flying. Instead, they use vehicles for such travel. The Old Testament informs us that the patriarch Jacob, spending the night in the field outside of Haran, saw a ladder set up on earth and its top reaching heavenwards, on which angels of the Lord were busy going up and down. The Lord himself stood at the top of the ladder, and the astounded Jacob was fearful, and he said, "Indeed, a God is present in this place, and I know it not. How awesome is this place! Indeed, this is none but the Lord's abode, and this is the gateway to heaven. There are two interesting points to this tale. The first is the divine beings going up and down this gateway to heaven were using a mechanical facility, a ladder. The second is that the sight took Jacob completely by surprise. The Lord's abode, the ladder, and the angels of the Lord using it were not there when Jacob lay down to sleep in the field. Suddenly, there was the awesome vision, and by morning, the abode, the ladder, and their occupants gone. We may conclude that the equipment used by the divine beings was some kind of craft that could appear over a place, hover for a while, and disappear from sight once again. The Old Testament also reports that the prophet Elijah did not die on earth, but went up into heaven by a whirlwind. Now, this was not a sudden and unexpected event. The ascent of Elijah to the heavens was prearranged. He was told to go to Bethel, the Lord's house, on a specific day. Rumors had already spread among his disciples that he was about to be taken up into the heavens. When they queried his deputy whether the rumor was true, he confirmed that indeed the Lord will take away the master today. And then there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, and Elijah went up into heaven by a whirlwind. Even more celebrated, and certainly better described, was the heavenly chariot seen by the prophet Ezekiel, who dwelt among the Judean deportees on the bank of the Khabur River in northern Mesopotamia. The heavens were opened, and I saw the appearances of the Lord. What Ezekiel saw was a man-like being, surrounded by brilliance and brightness, sitting on a throne that rested on a metal firmament within the chariot. The vehicle itself, which could move whichever way upon wheels within wheels and rise off the ground vertically, was described by the prophet as a glowing whirlwind. Some recent students of the biblical description, such as Joseph F. Bloomrich of NASA, have concluded that the chariot, seen by Ezekiel, was a helicopter consisting of a cabin resting on four posts, each equipped with rotary wings. A whirlwind, indeed. About 2 millennia earlier, when Sumerian ruler Gudea commemorating his building of the temple for his god Ninurta, he wrote that there appeared to him a man that shone like heaven. By the helmet on his head, he was a god. When Ninurta and two divine companions appeared to Gudea, they were standing beside Ninurta's divine black windbird. As it turned out, the main purpose for the temple's construction was to provide a secure zone, an inner special enclosure within the temple grounds for this divine bird. The similarity of the biblical and Sumerian descriptions, both of the vehicles and the beings with them, is obvious. The description of the vehicles as bird, windbird, and whirlwind that could rise heavenward while emitting a brilliance leaves no doubt that they were some kind of flying machine. Enigmatic murals uncovered at the Tel Gassul site east of the Dead Sea include two designs of mechanical craft that could well have been the whirlwinds of antiquity. An ancient coin found at Byblos on the Mediterranean coast of present-day Lebanon depicts a two-part temple. In the center of the sacred area stands a special platform, and on the stands an object called Mu, that which rises straight. There's evidence to show that the people of the eastern Mediterranean had seen rocket-like objects not only in the temple enclosure, but actually in flight. Hittites, for example, showed against a background of starry heavens cruising missiles, rockets mounted on launch pads, and a god inside a radiating chamber. Indeed, a rocket with wings or fins, reachable by a ladder, can be seen on a tablet excavated at Gezer, a town in ancient Canaan west of Jerusalem. Wishing to worship their gods throughout the lands, the ancient peoples developed the custom of setting up imitations of the god within his divine sky chamber. Stone pillars shaped to simulate the oval vehicle were erected at selected sites, and the image of the god was carved into the stone to indicate that he was within the object. Biblical references indicate familiarity with two types of commemorative monument, the Yad and the Shem. The prophet Isaiah conveyed to suffering people of Judea the Lord's promise of a better and safer future. And I will give them in my house and within my walls a Yad and a Shem. Literally translated, this would amount to the Lord's promise to provide his people with a hand and a name. Fortunately, however, from ancient monuments called Yads that still stand in the Holy Land, we learn that they were distinguished by tops shaped like pyramidions. The Shem, on the other hand, was a memorial with an oval top. Both, seems evident, began as simulations of the sky chamber, the God's vehicle for ascending to the eternal abode. The persistence of biblical translators to employ name whenever they encounter Shem has ignored a far-sighted study published more than a century ago by G. M. Redslob, in which he pointed out that the term Shem stems from the root word shema, meaning that which is highward. When the Old Testament reports that King David made a sham to mark his victory over the Arameans, Red Slob said he did not make a name, but set up a monument pointing skyward. The realization that Shem in many Mesopotamian texts should be read not as name, but as sky vehicle, opens the way to the understanding of the true meaning of many ancient tales, including the biblical story of the Tower of Babel. Genesis reports on the attempt by humans to raise up a Shem. The biblical tale of the Tower of Babel deals with events that followed the repopulation of Earth after the deluge, or the flood, when some of the people journeyed from the east and found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. The land of Shinar is, of course, the land of Sumer, in the plain between the two rivers of southern Mesopotamia. And the people said, "Let us build us a city, and a tower whose top shall reach the heavens, and let us make a Shem, lest we be scattered upon the face of the earth." The traditional translation of Shem as name has kept the tale unintelligible for generations. Why did the ancient residents of Babylonia exert themselves to make a name? Why was the name to be placed upon a tower whose top shall reach the heavens? And how could the making of a name counteract the effects of mankind's scattering on the earth? We believe that the answers to all of these questions become plausible once we read Skyborne Vehicle rather than name for the word Shem. The story would then deal with the concern of mankind that, as the people spread upon the earth, they would lose contact with one another. So they decided to build a skyborne vehicle and to erect a launch tower for such a vehicle so that they, too, could fly, like the goddess Ishtar, for example, all over the people's lands. However, men, assert both Mesopotamian and biblical texts, could ascend to the heavenly abode only upon the express wish of the gods. The Old Testament records the ascent to the heavens of several mortal beings. The Sumerian texts also speak of several men who were privileged to ascend to the heavens. One was Adapa, the mortal man created by Ea. The futile search by mortal man for the tree of life is the subject of one of the longest, most powerful epic texts bequeathed to human culture by the Sumerian civilization. Named by modern scholars the Epic of Gilgamesh, the moving tale concerns the ruler of Uruk, who was born to a mortal father and a divine mother, a circumstance that prompted him to seek escape from the death that was the fate of mortals. The distant journey Gilgamesh undertook was a journey to the abode of the gods. He was accompanied by his comrade Enkidu. He said to his comrade, "I will enter the land, set up my Shem in the places where the Shems were raised up. I would raise my Shem." An unfortunate break in the tablet leaves us ignorant regarding the location of the landing place, but wherever it was, Gilgamesh and his companion finally reached its outskirts. It was a restricted zone protected by awesome guards. Weary and sleepy, the two friends decided to rest overnight before continuing. No sooner had sleep overcome them than something shook them up and awoke them. "Didst thou arouse me?" Gilgamesh asked his comrade. "Am I awake?" he wondered, for he was witnessing unusual sights, so awesome that he wondered whether he was awake or dreaming. He told Enkidu, "In my dream, my friend, the high ground toppled. It laid me low, trapped my feet. The glaring was overpowering. A man appeared, the fairest in the land was he. His grace, from under the toppled ground, he pulled me out. He gave me water to drink. My heart quieted." Gilgamesh fell asleep again, but not for long. He started up, saying to his friend, "My friend, didst thou call me? Why am I awake? Didst thou not touch me? Why am I startled? Did not some god go by? Why is my flesh numb?" Thus mysteriously reawakened, Gilgamesh wondered who had touched him. If it wasn't his comrade, was it some god who went by? Once more, Gilgamesh dozed off, only to be awakened a third time. He described the awesome occurrence to his friend. "The vision that I saw was wholly awesome. The heavens shrieked, the earth boomed, daylight failed, darkness came, lightning flashed, a flame shot up, the clouds swelled, it rained death. Then the glow vanished, the fire went out, and all that had fallen had turned to ashes." One needs little imagination to see in these few verses an ancient account of the witnessing of a launching of a rocket ship. First, the tremendous thud as the rocket engines ignited, the heavens shrieked, accompanied by a marked shaking of the ground, the earth boomed. Clouds of smoke and dust enveloped the launching site. Daylight failed, darkness came. Then the brilliance of the ignited engine showed through. Lightning flashed as the rocket ship began to climb skyward. A flame shot up. The cloud of dust and debris swelled in all directions. Then, as it began to fall down, it rained death. Now the rocket ship was high in the sky, streaking heavenward. The glow vanished. The fire went out. The rocket ship was gone from sight, and the debris that had fallen had turned to ashes. He was now near to his first objective, the place where the Shems are raised up, but the entrance to the site, apparently cut into the mountain, was guarded by fierce guards. Their terror is awesome, their glance is death, their shimmering spotlight sweeps the mountains. The description brings to mind the statement in the book of Genesis that God placed the revolving sword at the entrance of the Garden of Eden to block its access to the humans. When Gilgamesh explained his partly divine origins and the purpose of his trip, the guards allowed him to go ahead. The damage and blurred text then has Gilgamesh arriving at a magnificent garden where the fruits and trees were carved out of semi-precious stones. It was there that Gilgamesh encountered a disappointing answer. Man cannot escape his mortal fate. However, Gilgamesh was offered a way to postpone death, the plant of youth. Triumphant, Gilgamesh obtained the plant, but as fate would have it, he foolishly lost it on his way back and returned to Uruk empty-handed. Putting aside the literary and philosophic values of the epic tale, the story of Gilgamesh interests us here primarily for its aerospace aspects. The Shem that Gilgamesh required in order to reach the abode of the gods was undoubtedly a rocket ship, the launching of one of which he had witnessed as he neared the landing place. The rockets, it would seem, were located inside a mountain, and the area was a well-guarded, restricted zone. Finally, let's look at the pictographic sign for gods in Sumerian. The term was a two-syllable word, Dinjir. The symbol Jir was a two-stage rocket with fins. Din, the first syllable, meant righteous, pure, bright. Put together then, Dinjir, as gods or divine beings, conveyed the meaning, the righteous ones of the bright pointed objects are, more explicitly, the pure ones of the blazing rockets. Can there be any doubt that the ancient peoples, in calling their deities gods of heaven and earth, meant literally that they were people from elsewhere who had come to earth from the heavens? Even the ancient compilers of the Old Testament, who dedicated the Bible to a single God, find it necessary to acknowledge the presence upon earth in early times of such divine beings. The enigmatic section forms the beginning of chapter 6 in Genesis, the review of the spread of mankind following Adam and the divine disenchantment with mankind that preceded the deluge or the flood. It states unequivocally that at that time, the sons of the gods saw the daughters of man that they were good, and they took them for wives, all of which they chose. The implication of these verses and the parallels to the Sumerian tells of gods and their sons and grandsons, and of semi-divine offspring resulting from cohabitation between gods and mortals, mount further as we continue to read the biblical verses. The Nephilim were upon the earth in those days and thereafter too, when the sons of the gods cohabited with the daughters of Adam, and they bore children unto them. They were the mighty ones of eternity, the people of the Shem. What does Nephilim mean? Stemming from Semitic root, it means those who were cast down upon earth. The Nephilim were the people of the Shem, the people of the rocket ships. The gods of heaven and earth of the ancient Near East not only originated in the heavens, but could also return to the heavenly abode. Realizing that such two-way travel between earth and the heavenly abode were practiced, the people of Sumer did not exile their gods to distant galaxies. The abode of the gods, their legacy discloses, was within our own solar system. An Assyrian depiction of the gateway of Anu in the heavenly abode confirms ancient familiarity with a celestial system such as our sun and its planets. The Sumerians steadfastly held to the opinion that in addition to the planets known to us today, there has been a 12th member of the solar system, the home planet of the Nephilim. We shall call it the 12th planet. The Sumerians were the first to divide the heavens into three bands or ways, the northern way, which was named after Enlil, the southern after Ea, and the central band was the way of Anu. The present-day central band, the band of the 12 constellations of the zodiac, corresponds exactly to the way of Anu, in which the Sumerians grouped the stars into 12 houses. Because the constellations and their subdivisions and even individual stars within the constellations have reached Western civilization with names and descriptions borrowed heavily from Greek mythology, the Western world tended for nearly two millennia to credit the Greeks with this achievement. But it's now apparent that the early Greek astronomers merely adopted into their language and mythology a ready-made astronomy attained from the Sumerians. The shift from one zodiacal house to another takes more than two millennia. Professor Langdon's findings revealed that the Nepurian calendar, established around 4400 BC in the age of Taurus, reflects knowledge of precession. Professor H. V. Hilprecht concluded that the number 12,960,000, on which the mathematical astronomical calculations were based, showed that the Sumerians knew the length of the great year, that it would be 25,920 Earth years. Now, this is indeed fantastic astronomical sophistication at an impossible time. The Sumerians referred to all celestial bodies as Muel, who shine in the heights, but some Muels were termed Lubad, clearly designating planets in our solar system. The texts leave no doubt our solar system was made up of 12 members. It included, in addition to the planets known to us, also the planet of Anu, the planet of the supreme scepter. We can now grasp the significance of the number 12 in the ancient world. The great circle of Sumerian gods, and of all Olympian gods thereafter, comprised exactly 12. Younger gods could join the circle only if older gods retired. Likewise, a vacancy had to be filled to retain the divine number 12. The principal celestial circle, the way of the sun with its 12 members, set the pattern, according to which each other celestial band was divided into 12 segments or was allocated 12 principal celestial bodies. Accordingly, there were 12 months in a year, 12 double hours in a day. Each division of Sumer was assigned 12 celestial bodies as a measure of good luck. Many studies show that the division of the year into 12 months was, from its very beginnings, related to the 12 great gods. The number 12 permeated all matters, celestial and divine, long after the Sumerians were gone. There were 12 Greek titans, 12 tribes of Israel, and the 12 apostles of Jesus. Where did this powerful, decisive number 12 stem from? From the heavens. Teaching humanity the true nature of Earth and the heavens, the Nephilim informed the ancient astronomer priest not only of the planets beyond Saturn, but also of the existence of the most important planet, the one from which they came, the 12th planet. And now we reach the climax of our search for answers to primeval celestial events, the existence of a 12th planet. Astonishing as it may sound, our astronomers have been looking for evidence that indeed such a planet once existed between Mars and Jupiter. Toward the end of the 18th century, even before Neptune had been discovered, several astronomers demonstrated that the planets were placed at certain distances from the Sun according to some definite law. The suggestion, which came to be known as Bode's Law, convinced astronomers that a planet ought to revolve in a place where hitherto no planet had been known to exist, that is, between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. Spurred by these mathematical calculations, astronomers began to scan the skies in the indicated zone for the missing planet. On the first day of the 19th century, the Italian astronomer Giuseppe Piazzi discovered at the exact indicated distance a very small planet, 485 miles across, which he named Ceres. By 1804, the number of asteroids, small planets, found there rose to 4. To date, nearly 3,000 asteroids have been counted orbiting the Sun and what is now called the asteroid belt. Beyond any doubt, this is the debris of a planet that had shattered to pieces. Russian astronomers have named it Phaeton. While astronomers are certain that such a planet existed, they're unable to explain its disappearance. Did the planet self-explode? But then its pieces would have thrown off in all directions and not stayed in a single belt. If a collision shattered the missing planet, where is the celestial body responsible for that collision? Did it also shatter? But the debris circling the Sun, when added up, is insufficient to account for even one whole planet, to say nothing of two. Also, if the asteroids comprise the debris of two planets, they should have retained the axial revolution of two planets. But all the asteroids have a single axial rotation, indicating that they come from a single celestial body. How then was the missing planet shattered, and what shattered it?
About a century ago, the decipherment of the text found in Mesopotamia unexpectedly grew into a realization that there, in Mesopotamia, text existed that not only paralleled but also preceded portions of the Holy Scripture. Now called the Creation Epic, the text tells us that two primeval celestial bodies gave birth to a series of celestial gods. As the number of celestial beings increased, they made great noise and commotion, disturbing the primeval father. His faithful messenger urged him to take strong measures to discipline the young gods, but they ganged up on him and robbed him of his creative powers. The primeval mother sought to take revenge. The god who led the revolt against the primeval father had a new suggestion. Let his young son be invited to join the assembly of gods and be given supremacy so that he might go fight single-handedly the monster their mother turned out to be. Granted supremacy, the young god, Marduk, proceeded to face the monster and after a fierce battle vanquished her and split her in two. Of one part of her he made heaven, and of the other, earth. He then proclaimed a fixed order in the heavens, assigning to each celestial god a permanent position. On earth, he produced the mountains and seas and rivers, established the seasons and vegetation, and created man. In duplication of the heavenly abode, Babylon and its towering temple were built on earth. Gods and mortals were given assignments and commandments, rituals to be followed. The gods then proclaimed Marduk, the supreme deity. As more tablets and fragments were found and translated, it became evident that the text was not a simple literary work. It was the most hallowed, historical, religious epic of Babylon, read as part of the New Year rituals. There's enough evidence here to show that the Babylonian version of the epic was a masterful, religious, political forgery of early Sumerian versions, in which Anu, Enlil, and Ninurta were the heroes. No matter, however, what the actors in this celestial and divine drama were called, the tale is certainly as ancient as Sumerian civilization. Most scholars see it as a philosophic work, the earliest version of the eternal struggle between good and evil, or the allegorical tale of nature's winter and summer, sunrise and sunset, death and resurrection. But why not take the epic at face value as nothing more nor less than the statement of the cosmologic facts as known to the Sumerians, as told to them by the Nephilim? Using such a bold and novel approach, we find that the epic of creation perfectly explains the events that probably took place in our solar system. Tiamat was the monster that Marduk later shattered, the missing planet. The authors of the creation epic raised the curtain on a drama of celestial turmoil. The approach of Marduk began to disturb Tiamat. He produced streams. The gods were not at rest, carried as in a storm. The gods decreed Marduk's destiny. Their combined gravitational pull determined Marduk's orbital path so that he could go but one way, toward a battle, a collision, with Tiamat. Subjected to the conflicting gravitational pulls, the large satellite of Tiamat began to shift toward Marduk. The die was cast. The course is irrevocably set on collision. Tiamat emitted a roar. As Marduk came even closer, Tiamat's fury grew. The roots of her legs shook back and forth. She commenced to cast spells against Marduk, but Marduk kept coming at her. They approached for battle. But the two planets did not collide, a fact of cardinal astronomical importance. It was the satellites of Marduk that smashed into Tiamat, and not Marduk himself. The first encounter between Marduk and Tiamat left her fissured and lifeless, but her final fate was still to be determined by future encounters between the two. It is here that the biblical tale of Genesis joins the Mesopotamian epic of creation, for it is not only at this point that the tale of the creation of earth and heaven really begins. Completing her first ever orbit around the sun, Marduk then returned to Tiamat, whom he had subdued. Marduk himself now hit the defeated planet, splitting Tiamat in two. Then another of Marduk's satellites crashed into the separated half. The heavy blow carried this part, destined to become Earth, to an orbit where no planet had been orbiting before. The other half of her he set up as a screen for the skies. The pieces of this broken half were hammered to become a bracelet in heaven, acting as a screen between the inner planets and the outer planets. They were stretched into a great band. The asteroid belt had been created. According to the creation epic, Marduk had at one point boasted, "The ways of the celestial gods I will artfully alter into two groups they shall be divided." Indeed he did. He eliminated from the heavens the sun's first partner in creation, Tiamat. He brought Earth into being, thrusting it into a new orbit nearer the sun. He hammered a bracelet in the heavens, the asteroid belt, that does separate the group of inner planets from the group of outer planets. He turned most of Tiamat's satellites into comets. Her chief satellite, Kingju, he put into orbit around Earth to become the moon. And he shifted a satellite of Saturn to become the planet Pluto. Having thus constructed the stations for the planets, Marduk crossed the heavens and surveyed the new solar system. It was now made up of 12 celestial bodies, with 12 great gods as their counterparts. The actual elevation of Marduk to the status of king of the gods upon earth was thus accompanied by assigning to him, as his celestial counterpart, the planet of the Nephilim, the 12th planet. As the lord of the celestial gods or the planets, Marduk was thus also king of the heavens. His orbit was loftier and grander than that of any other planet. The text described the planet as going from heaven's base to a lordly abode. The creation epic said of Marduk, "He crossed the heaven and surveyed the regions. The structure of the deep the Lord then measured. Ishara he established as his outstanding abode. Ishara as a great abode in the heavens he established." One abode was thus far in the deep regions of space. The other was established in the heaven within the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. Like the Mesopotamian text, many books of the Old Testament describe the Lord as having his abode in the heights of heaven, where he beheld the foremost planets, a celestial Lord who, unseen in the heavens, moves about in a circle. Recognized as a great traveler in the heavens, soaring to immense heights at its apogee and then coming down, bowing unto heaven at its perigee, the planet was depicted as a winged globe. Wherever archaeologists uncovered the remains of Near Eastern peoples, the symbol of the winged globe was conspicuous, dominating temples and palaces, carved on rocks, etched on cylinder seals, painted on walls. The ancient peoples not only expected the periodic arrival of the 12th planet, but also charted its advancing course. Various biblical passages, especially in Isaiah, Amos, and Job, relate the movement of the celestial Lord to various constellations. The anticipation of the day of the Lord in the ancient Mesopotamian and Hebrew writings, which were echoed in the New Testament's expectations of the coming of the kingship of heaven, was thus based on the actual experiences of earth people. They are witnessing the periodic return of the planet of kingship to earth's vicinity. The planet's periodic appearance and disappearance from earth's view confirms the assumption of its permanence in a solar orbit. In this, it acts like many comets. Some of the known comets, like Halley's Comet, which nears Earth every 75 years, disappeared from view for such long times that astronomers were hard-pressed to realize that they were seeing the same comet. This may also be the way in which astronomers will discover the 12th planet. Now, there's already been speculation that a planet X exists, which, though unseen, may be sensed through its effect on the orbits of certain comets. In 1972, Joseph L. Brady of the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory at the University of California discovered that discrepancies in the orbit of Halley's Comet could be caused by a planet the size of Jupiter orbiting the Sun every 1,800 years. While such an orbital period can't be ruled out, biblical sources present strong evidence that the orbital period of the 12th planet is 3,600 years. Before we turn to the ancient records regarding the voyages of the Nephilim to Earth and their settlement on Earth, two basic questions need to be answered. Could beings obviously not much different from us evolve on another planet? Could such beings have had the capability half a million years ago for interplanetary travel? Life, scientists have concluded, evolved not upon the terrestrial planets with the heavy chemical components, but in the outer fringes of the solar system. From these fringes of the solar system, the 12th planet came into our midst, a reddish, glowing planet generating and radiating its own heat, providing from its own atmosphere the ingredients needed for the chemistry of life. If a puzzle exists, it is the appearance of life on Earth. Earth was formed 4.5 billion years ago, and scientists believe that the simpler forms of life were already present on Earth within a few hundred million years thereafter. This is simply much too soon for comfort. What this suggests to the baffled scientists is the fact that life, which could easily evolve on Earth, did not in fact evolve on Earth. Writing in the scientific magazine Icarus, Nobel Prize winner Francis Crick, who discovered the DNA molecule, and Dr. Leslie Orgel advanced the theory that life on Earth may have sprung from tiny organisms from a distant planet. These two eminent scientists came close to the real fact. There was no premeditated seeding. Instead, there was a celestial collision. A life-bearing planet, the 12th planet and its satellites, collided with Tiamat and split it in two, creating Earth of its half. During that collision, the life-bearing soil and air of the 12th planet seeded Earth, giving it the biological and complex early forms of life for whose early appearance there is no other explanation. The Nephilim's own planet, with its vast orbit, served as a traveling observatory. No wonder, then, that when they landed on Earth, a good deal of the knowledge they brought with them contained astronomy and celestial mathematics. No wonder, too, that even the earliest and crudest sculptures and drawings bore celestial symbols of constellations and planets, and that when the gods were to be represented or invoked, their celestial symbols were used as a graphic shorthand. Some of the symbols, we believe, also convey information that could be related only to space travel to Earth. A stela, erected by an Assyrian king, shows the ruler holding a cup of life while facing the 12 chief gods of heaven and earth. Four of the gods are shown as celestial bodies: the sun, the winged globe, the moon's crescent, and seven dots. Ample evidence shows that in olden times, the crescent was the symbol of an elderly and bearded deity, one of Sumer's true olden gods. Often showed surrounded by streams of water, this god is undoubtedly Ea. The crescent was also associated with the science of measuring and calculated, of which Ea was the divine master. What was the meaning of the symbol of the seven dots? Many clues leave no doubt that it was the celestial symbol of Enlil. The depiction of the gateway of Anu, flanked by Ea and Enlil, represents them by the crescent and the seven-dot symbol. Scholars have been unable to understand a statement by Gudea, king of Lagash, that the celestial seven is 50. Now, attempts at arithmetic solutions, some formula whereby the number seven would go into 50, fail to reveal the meaning of that statement. However, we see a simple answer. Gudea stated that the celestial body that is seven stands for the god that is 50. The god Enlil, whose right number was 50, had as his celestial counterpart the planet that was seventh. Which planet was the planet of Enlil? We recall the text that speaks of the early times when the gods first came to Earth, when Anu stayed on the 12th planet and his two sons who had gone down to Earth drew lots. Ea was given the rulership over the deep, and to Enlil, the Earth was given for his dominion. And the answer to the puzzle burst out in all of its significance. The planet Enlil was Earth. Earth, to the Nephilim, was the seventh planet. Another piece of this puzzle is worth noting. To someone nearing our solar system from the outside, the first planet to be encountered would be Pluto. The second, Neptune. The third, Uranus, not Earth. Fourth would be Saturn. Fifth, Jupiter. Sixth, Mars. And Earth would be the seventh. Earth is not the only planet whose numerical position in the solar system was represented symbolically. Ample evidence shows that Venus was depicted as an eight-pointed star. Venus is the eighth planet, following Earth, when counted from the outside. The eight-pointed star also stood for the goddess Ishtar, whose planet was Venus. The central religious event of ancient Mesopotamia, the 12-day New Year festival, was replete with symbolism that had to do with the orbit of the 12th planet, the makeup of the solar system, and the journey of the Nephilim to Earth. The best documented of these affirmations of faith were the Babylonian New Year rituals. The essence of the ceremony was a holy procession that saw the reigning gods leave his abode or temple and go, via several stations, to a place well out of town. A special ship, a divine boat, was used for the purpose. Then the god, successful in his mission, returned to the city by the same divine boat and retraced his course back to the temple amid feasting and rejoicing by the king and populace. Excavations conducted over some 20 years on the site of ancient Babylon, brilliantly correlated with Babylonian ritual text, enabled teams of scholars to reconstruct the holy precinct of Marduk. The symbolic names of seven stations and Marduk at each station were given in both Akkadian and Sumerian, attesting both to the antiquity and to the Sumerian origins of the procession and its symbolism. The seventh station was the house of building life on Earth. There, Marduk took the title God of the House of Resting. It is our contention that the seven stations in the procession of Marduk represented the space trip of the Nephilim from their planet to Earth. Taking into consideration that their own planet and their target Earth were both in continuous motion, the Nephilim had to aim their craft not at where Earth was at launch time, but where it would be at arrival time. One can safely assume that the Nephilim worked out their trajectories very much as modern scientists mapped the missions to the moon and other planets. Based on complex technical data, as well as hints in Mesopotamian text, it appears that the Nephilim adopted for their Earth missions the same approach NASA adopted for the moon missions. When the principal spaceship neared the Earth, it went into orbit around Earth without actually landing. Instead, a smaller craft was released from the mothership and performed the actual landing. As difficult as accurate landings were, the departures from Earth must have been even trickier. The landing craft had to rejoin its mothership, which then had to fire up its engines and accelerate to extremely high speeds, where it had to catch up with the 12th planet, which by then was passing its perigee between Mars and Jupiter at its top orbital speed. Suitable terrain, guidance from Earth, and perfect coordination with the home planet were required for successful arrivals, landings, takeoffs, and departures from Earth. As we shall see, the Nephilim met all of these requirements. The story of the first settlement of Earth by intelligent beings is a breathtaking saga no less inspiring than the discovery of America or the circumnavigation of Earth. The Epic of Creation informs us that the gods came to Earth following a deliberate decision by their leader. Marduk explained his purpose. Wind from the heavens, for assembly you shall descend. There shall be a rest place for the night, to receive you all. I will name it Babylon, the gateway to the gods. Earth was thus not merely the object of visit or quick exploratory stay. It was to be a permanent home away from home. As the Nephilim searched for an additional home, Earth must have struck them favorably. Its blue hues indicated it had life-sustaining water and air. Its browns disclosed firm lands, its greens vegetation, and the basis for animal life. Yet when the Nephilim finally voyaged to Earth, it must have looked somewhat different from the way it does to our astronauts today. For when the Nephilim first came to Earth, Earth was in the midst of an ice age, a glacial period that was one of the icing and de-icing phases of Earth's climate. Arriving on Earth amid such climatic and geographic conditions, where were the Nephilim to set up their first abode? They searched, no doubt, for a place with a relatively temperate climate, where simple shelters would suffice. They must also have searched for water for drinking, washing, and industrial purposes, as well as to sustain the plant and animal life needed for food. Rivers would both facilitate the irrigation of large tracts of land and provide a convenient means of transportation. The attention of the Nephilim, as we now know, focused on three major river systems and their plains: the Nile, the Indus, and the Tigris-Euphrates. Each of these river basins were suitable for early colonizations. Each, in time, became the center of an ancient civilization. The book of Genesis describes God's abode on Earth, Eden, as a place of temperate climate, warm yet breezy. It was a place of good soil, lending itself to agriculture and horticulture. It was a place that drew its waters from a network of four rivers, and the name of the third river was Tigris. It was one which flowed toward the east of Assyria, and the fourth was the Euphrates. The selection of Mesopotamia as the home on Earth was probably motivated by at least one other important consideration. Though the Nephilim in time established a spaceport on dry land, some evidence suggests that at least initially they landed by splashing down into the sea in a hermetically sealed capsule. If this was the landing method, Mesopotamia offered proximity to two seas, the Indian Ocean to the south and the Mediterranean to the west. Sumerian depictions frequently show massive structures built in earliest times of reeds and wood, standing in fields among grazing cattle. The current assumption that these were the stables for cattle is contradicted by the pillars that are invariably shown protruding from the roofs of such structures. The pillars' purpose was to support pairs of rings. Were the pairs of rings radar emitters, placed in the fields to guide the incoming shuttlecraft? Were the eye-like pillars scanning devices the all-seeing eyes of the gods of which many texts have spoken? The flat plane necessitated, it seems, the artificial raising of platforms on which the space-related equipment was to be placed. Text and depictions leave no doubt that the structures range from the earliest field huts to the later staged platforms reached by stairways and sloped ramps that led from a broad lower stage to a narrower upper one. At the top, an actual residence for the god was built, surrounded by a flat-walled courtyard to house his bird and weapons. Even scholars who have approached the subject without our space interpretation could not escape the conclusion that the ziggurats had some purpose other than to make the god's abode a high-rise building. Samuel N. Kramer summed up the scholastic consensus. The ziggurat, the stage tower which became the hallmark of Mesopotamian temple architecture, was intended to serve as a connecting link, both real and symbolic, between the gods in heaven and the mortals on earth. We have shown, however, that the true function of these structures was to connect the gods of heaven with the gods, not the mortals, on earth. The Sumerian text explains that at the very early stage of the arrival of the gods on earth, a separation of power was agreed upon. Anu was to stay in the heavens and rule over the 12th planet, Enlil was to command the lands, and Enki was to be put in charge of the Abzu. Now, it was a distant land with flowing waters, bursting with riches, a place that lay beyond a sea. Literally, the term Abzu meant the primeval deep source. According to Sumerian grammatical rules, the term could also be written Zuab without changing its meaning. The latter spelling enables identification of its parallel in the Semitic language, for Zuab means precious metal, specifically gold. The pictographic signs employed as Sumer's first writing reveal great familiarity not only with diverse metallurgical processes, but also with the fact that the sources of the metals were mines dug down into the earth. The terms for copper, bronze, and gold, or refined, were all variants of a mine shaft. A lively metals trade existed in the very beginnings of civilization, the result of knowledge bequeathed to mankind by the gods, who, the texts state, had engaged in mining and metallurgy long before man's appearance. The Old Testament recognized the land of Ophir, which is probably somewhere in Africa, as a source of gold in antiquity. Many biblical scholars have suggested Ophir should be identified with the former Rhodesia, now called Zimbabwe. Z. Herman brought together evidence showing that the Egyptians obtained various minerals from Zimbabwe in earliest times. In fact, scientists have suggested that southern Africa could well have been in the forefront of technological invention and innovation during much of the period subsequent to 100,000 B.C. Commenting on the discoveries, Dr. Kenneth Oakley, former head anthropologist of the Natural History Museum in London, saw quite a different significance to the finds. It throws important light on the origins of man. It's now possible that southern Africa was the evolutionary home of man, the birthplace of Homo sapiens. As we shall show, it was indeed there that modern man appeared on Earth through a chain of events triggered by the gods' search for metals. Man's infatuation with gold is traceable to the beginnings of his civilization and religion, to his contacts with the ancient gods. The gods of Sumer required that they be served food from golden trays, water and wine from golden vessels, and they be clad in golden garments. The Nephilim, it appears, came to earth for gold and its related metals. They may have also come for another rare metal, such as platinum, which can power fuel cells in an extraordinary manner. The ancient texts describe the Anunnaki as the rank-and-file gods who had been involved in the settlement of Earth, the gods who performed the task. The Babylonian Epic of Creation credited Marduk with giving the Anunnaki their assignments. One text relates how Marduk rushed to his father Ea to report the loss of a spacecraft carrying the Anunnaki, who are 50, as it passed near Saturn. Could it be that 50 was the number of Nephilim in each landing party? As the visits to Earth became regular, more Nephilim would arrive, and the number who stayed to colonize Earth grew from the initial landing party of 50 to the 600 who on Earth settled. How did the Nephilim expect to achieve their mission to mine on Earth its desired minerals and ship the ingots back to the 12th planet with such a small number of hands? The story begins in the time when only the gods lived on Earth. When the gods, like men, bore the work and suffered the toil of the gods was great, the work was heavy, the distress was much. Seven cities were established, and the text refers to seven Anunnaki who were city commanders. Discipline must have been strict, for the text tells us the seven great Anunnaki were making the lesser gods suffer the work. For a long time, the Anunnaki suffered the toil, and then they cried, "No more." The occasion for the mutiny appears to have been a visit by Enlil to the mining area. The Anunnaki stood together. "Every single one of us gods has war declared. Excessive toil has killed us. Our work was heavy, the distress much." When Enlil heard the report of these grievances, his tears flowed. Ea had a solution to offer. Let a primitive worker be created. The suggestion was readily accepted. Unanimously, the gods voted to create the worker. "Man shall be his name," they said. A mutiny of the gods had led to the creation of man. The assertion first recorded and transmitted by the Sumerians that man was created by the Nephilim appears at first sight to clash both with the theory of evolution and with Judeo-Christian tenets based on the Bible. But, in fact, the information contained in the Sumerian text and only that information can affirm both the validity of the theory of evolution and the truth of the biblical tale, and show that there really is no conflict at all between the two. The Sumerian text recorded instance after instance of events that had taken place when man had not yet been created, when Nippur was inhabited by the gods alone. At the same time, the text also described the creation of Earth and the development of a plant and animal life on it in terms that conform to the current evolutionary theories. All the Sumerian texts assert that the gods created man to do their work. Similarly, no sooner had the biblical deity, like the gods in the Sumerian accounts, created man, than he planted a garden and assigned man to work there. And the Lord God took the man and placed him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to tend it. In the Sumerian versions, the decision to create man was adopted by the gods in their assembly. Significantly, the book of Genesis, purportedly exalting the achievements of a sole deity, uses the plural Elohim, literally deities, to denote God, and reports an astonishing remark. And Elohim said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." Whom did the sole but plural deity address? And who were the us in whose plural image and plural likeness man was to be made? Condensing the many gods into a single supreme deity, the biblical tale is but an edited version of the Sumerian reports of the discussions in the assembly of the gods. Lacking only certain knowing and a divine span of life, the Adam of the Garden of Eden was in all other respects created in the image and likeness of his creator. The use of both terms in the text was meant to leave no doubt that man was similar to God, both physically and emotionally, externally and internally. But how, indeed, was man created? The Western world has long wedded to the notion that, created deliberately, man was put on earth to subdue it and to have dominion over all other creatures. Then, in November 1859, an English naturalist by the name of Charles Darwin published a treatise called On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. Summing up nearly 30 years of research, the book added to earlier thoughts about natural evolution the concept of natural selection as a consequence of the struggle of all species, of plant and animal alike, for existence. Darwin's shattering bombshell was the conclusion that all living things, man included, were products of evolution. Man, contrary to the then-held belief, was not generated spontaneously. It seemed that the very words of the Old Testament were indefensible. For how could a God who has no corporal body and who is universally alone say, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness"? But are we really nothing more than naked apes? Is the monkey just an evolutionary arm's length away from us? Evolution can explain the general course of events that cause life and life's forms to develop on Earth, from the simplest one-cell creature to man. But evolution cannot account for the appearance of Homo sapiens, which happened virtually overnight in terms of the millions of years evolution requires. The scholars have no explanation, but we do. Aryan and Babylonian texts do. The Old Testament does. Homo sapiens, modern man, was brought about by the ancient gods. Here then is the answer to the puzzle. The Nephilim did not create man out of nothing. Rather, they took an existing creature and manipulated it to bind upon it the image of the gods. As the Nephilim looked about them, they saw not only the predominant mammals, but also the primates, among them the man-like apes. Is it not possible that the roaming bands of Homo erectus were lured to come close to observe the fiery objects rising to the sky? Is it not possible that the Nephilim observed, encountered, even captured some of those interesting primates? Faced with the need for manpower, resolved to obtain a primitive worker, the Nephilim saw a ready-made solution: to domesticate a suitable animal. If, as the ancient evidence and modern science seem to confirm, life on Earth germinated from life on the 12th planet, then evolution on Earth should have proceeded as it had on the 12th planet. Observing the various forms of life on Earth, the Nephilim and their chief scientist, Ea, needed little time to realize what had happened. During the celestial collision, their planet had seeded Earth with its life. Therefore, the being that was available was really akin to the Nephilim, though in a less evolved form. The process that Ea recommended in order to achieve a quick evolutionary advancement of Homo erectus was, we believe, genetic manipulation. We should assume that the Nephilim, being capable of space travel 450,000 years ago, were as equally advanced compared to us today in the field of life sciences. We should also assume that they were aware of the various alternatives by which two preselected sets of chromosomes could be combined to obtain a predetermined genetic results, and that whether the process was akin to cloning or cell fusion, genetic transplant, or methods as yet unknown to us, they knew these processes and could carry them out. Sumerian texts speak of deformed humans created by Enki and the Mother Goddess in the course of their efforts to fashion a perfect primitive worker. But finally, the perfect man was achieved, the one Enki named Adapa, the Bible Adam, our scholars, Homo sapiens. With this final product, the Nephilim were genetically compatible with the daughters of man and able to marry them and have children by them. But such compatibility could exist only if man had developed from the same seed of life as the Nephilim. Man in the Mesopotamian concept, as the biblical one, was made of a mixture of a godly element, a god's blood or its essence, and the clay of earth. The second chapter of Genesis offers this version. And Yahweh fashioned the Adam of the clay of the soil, and he blew in his nostrils the breath of life, and the Adam turned into a living soul. Adam was used as the genetic model or mold for the creation of duplicates, and those duplicates were not only male, but male and female. The ancient legends and myths, biblical information, and modern science are also compatible in one more aspect. Like the findings of modern anthropologists, that man evolved and emerged in Southeast Africa, the Mesopotamian text suggests that the creation of man took place in the Apsu, the lower world, where the land of mines was located. One can even conclude from the various texts that the creation of man caused a rift among the gods. It would appear that at least at first, the new primitive workers were confined to the land of mines. As a result, the Anunnaki, who were toiling in Sumer proper, were denied the benefits of the new manpower. Now, a puzzling text, named by the scholars the Myth of the Pickaxe, is in fact the record of the events whereby the Anunnaki, who stayed in Sumer under Enlil, obtained their fair share of the black-headed people. Grateful, the Anunnaki lost no time in putting them to work. The book of Genesis likewise conveys the information that the Adam was created somewhere west of Mesopotamia, then brought over eastward to work in the Garden of Eden. The only complete account of the events that befell man following his transportation to the abode of the gods in Mesopotamia is the biblical tale of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And the deity Yahweh commanded the Adam, saying, "Of every tree of the orchard eat you shall, but of the tree of knowing good and evil thou shalt not eat of it. For on the day thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die." An idyllic picture soon gave way to dramatic developments, which biblical scholars and theologians call the fall of man. And the serpent said unto the woman, "Nay, you will surely not die. It is that the deity doth know that on the day you eat thereof, your eyes will be opened, and you will be as the deity, knowing good and evil." And the woman saw that the tree was good to eat, and that it was lustful to behold, and the tree was desirable to make one wise. And she took of its fruit and did eat, and gave also to her mate with her, and he ate. And the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths. One cannot seriously assume that the purpose of the whole incident, which led to the expulsion of the earthlings from the Garden of Eden, was a dramatic way to explain how man came to wear clothes. The wearing of clothes was merely an outward manifestation of the new knowing. The acquisition of such knowing, and the deity's attempts to deprive man of it, are the central themes of the events. Throughout the Old Testament, the term to know is used to denote sexual intercourse, mostly between a man and his spouse, for the purpose of having children. The tale of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden is the story of a crucial step in man's development, the acquisition of the ability to procreate. That the first representatives of Homo sapiens were incapable of reproduction should not be surprising. Whatever method the Nephilim had used to infuse some of their genetic material into the biological makeup of the hominids they selected, the new being was a hybrid, a cross between two different if related species. Like a mule, such mammal hybrids are sterile. Were the Nephilim at first simply producing human mules to suit their requirements? After Enki managed to produce a perfect model, mass production techniques are described in the Sumerian text. The implanting of the genetically treated ova in a production line of birth goddesses with the advanced knowledge that half would produce males and half would produce females. Not only does this bespeak the technique which the hybrid man was manufactured, it also implies that man could not procreate on his own. Was that what the god, the serpent, accomplished for mankind? We recall that in all ancient traditions, the chief deity fought a serpent adversary, a tale whose roots undoubtedly go back to Sumerian gods. The possibility that the biblical antagonist, the deity and the serpent, stood for Enlil and Enki seems to us entirely plausible. Their antagonism originated in the transfer to Enlil the command of Earth, although Enki had been the true pioneer. While Enlil stayed at the comfortable mission control center, Enki was set to organize the mining operations in the lower world. The mutiny of the Anunnaki was directed by Enlil. The god who spoke out for the mutineers was Enki. It was Enki who suggested and undertook the creation of primitive workers. Enki emerges as mankind's protagonist, Enlil as its strict discipliner, not outright antagonist. The role of deity wishing to keep the new humans sexually suppressed, and of deity willing and capable of bestowing on mankind the fruit of knowing, fit Enlil and Enki perfectly. After man's acquisition of knowing, the Old Testament ceases to refer to him as the Adam and adopts its subject Adam, a specific person, the first patriarch of a line of people with whom the Bible was concerned. But this coming of age of mankind also marked a schism between God and man. Cast out of the abode of the gods, doomed to a mortal's life, but able to procreate, man proceeded to do just that. The Old Testament is an ongoing tale of human events henceforth anchored in the lineage of Adam through his son Seth and then the 10 generations more ending with Noah, the hero of the deluge. Humanity, it appears, was undergoing great deprivations when Noah was born. The stage was set for the deluge, the momentous event which was to wipe off the face of the earth not only the human race but all life upon the land and in the skies. And the deity saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth. And the deity repented that he had made man upon the earth, and his heart grieved. And the deity said, I will destroy the earthling whom I have created off the face of the earth. These are broad accusations presented as justifications for drastic measures to end all flesh. But they lack specificity. The scholars and the theologians alike find no satisfactory answers regarding the sins or violations that could have upset the deity so much. The repeated use of the term flesh, both in the accusative verses and in the proclamations of judgment, suggests, of course, that the corruptions and violations had to do with the flesh. However, there is a profusion of texts describing lovemaking and actual intercourse among the gods. Such gods could hardly turn against mankind for behaving as they themselves did. The deity's motive, we find, was not merely concern for human morals. The mounting disgust was caused by a spreading defilement of the gods themselves. It was when the sons of the gods began to be sexually involved with earthlings' offspring that the deity cried, Enough! And the deity said, My spirit shall not shield man forever. Having strayed, he is but flesh. The spirit of the gods, their genetic perfection of mankind, was beginning to deteriorate. Mankind had strayed, thereby reverting to being but flesh, closer to its animal origins. Noah alone continued to be genetically pure. Thus, the deity decided to save Noah and his descendants, and every clean animal and other beast and fowls, so as to keep the seed alive upon the face of the earth. And it came to pass after the 7 days that the waters of the deluge were upon the earth. What was this deluge, this flood, whose raging waters swept over the earth? Some explain the flood in terms of the annual inundations of the Tigris-Euphrates plain. One such inundation, it is surmised, must have been particularly severe. Fields and cities, men and beasts were swept away by the rising waters, and primitive peoples, seeing the event as punishment by the gods, began to propagate the legend of a deluge. We shall find that the deluge was not a premeditated punishment brought on by the gods at their exclusive will. Though the deluge was a predictable event, it was an unavoidable one, a natural calamity in which the gods played not an active but a passive role. We will also show that the secret the gods swore to was a conspiracy against mankind to withhold from the earthlings the information they had regarding the coming avalanche of water so that while the Nephilim saved themselves, mankind should perish. Much of our greatly increased knowledge of the deluge and the events preceding it comes from the text when the gods as men. In this, the hero of the deluge was called Atrahasis. After describing the hard work of the Anunnaki, their mutiny, and the ensuing creation of the primitive worker, the epic relates how man, as we also know from the biblical version, began to procreate and multiply. In time, mankind began to upset Enlil. Enlil then ordered a punishment. We would expect to read now of the coming deluge. Instead, he called for the decimation of mankind through pestilence and sickness. Atrahasis appealed to Enki to undo his brother Enlil's plan. Soon thereafter, Enlil complained bitterly to the gods that the people have not diminished. They are more numerous than before. He then proceeded to outline the extermination of mankind through starvation. The sight of a starving, disintegrating mankind, of parents eating their own children, brought about another confrontation between Enki and Enlil. Mankind received a message from Enki. Do not revere your gods. Do not pray to your goddesses. There was to be total disobedience, and Enlil was filled with anger. He accused his brother of breaking plans agreed upon by the gods. But there was still a chance to doom mankind. A killing flood was in the offing. The approaching catastrophe had to be kept secret from the people. He called on the assembly to swear themselves to secrecy, and most important, to bind Prince Enki by an oath. At first, he refused to take the oath. Why will you bind me with an oath, he asked. Am I to raise my hands against my own humans? But he was finally forced to take the oath. As Enki chose to interpret it, he swore not to reveal the secret of the coming deluge to the people, but could he not tell it to a wall? Calling Atrahasis to the temple, he made him stay behind a screen. Enki's advice to his faithful servant was to build a waterborne vessel. The Akkadian text quotes Enki as calling for a boat roofed over and below, hermetically sealed. Indeed, only such a boat could have survived an overpowering avalanche of waters. Aware of the impending calamity, the Nephilim took steps to save their own skins. With Earth about to be engulfed by water, they could go in only one direction for protection, skyward. When the storm that preceded the deluge began to blow, the Nephilim took off in their shuttlecraft and remained in Earth orbit until the waters began to subside. The day of the deluge, we will show, was the day the gods fled from the earth. Orbiting Earth, the Nephilim saw a scene of destruction that affected them deeply. The Gilgamesh texts tell us that as the storm grew in intensity, not only could no one see his fellow, but neither could the people be recognized from the heavens. Crammed into their spacecraft, the gods strained to see what was happening on the planet from which they had just blasted off. The mother goddess herself, Ninhursag, bewailed what she was seeing. My creatures had become like flies. They filled the rivers like dragonflies. Their fatherhood was taken by the rolling sea. Could she, indeed, save her own life, while mankind, which she helped create, was dying? Forced to abandon Earth, the gods suddenly realized how attached they had become to it and its inhabitants. In one craft, Anunnaki debated the merits of the orders given. In another, Ishtar cried out, "The olden days, alas, are turned into clay." The Anunnaki, who were in her craft, wept with her. Enki was in yet another spacecraft, or else he would have disclosed to the others that he had managed to save the seed of mankind. The ancient versions appear to imply that the Ark was carried to the region of Ararat by the torrential waves. The Nephilim, as we have shown, used the peaks of Ararat as landmarks from the very beginning. As the highest peaks in that part of the world, they could be expected to reappear first from under the mantle of water. Since Enki, the wise one, the all-knowing, certainly could figure that much out, we can surmise that he had instructed his servant to guide the ark toward Ararat, planning an encounter from the very beginning. As soon as Atrahasis had landed, he slaughtered some animals and roasted them on fire. No wonder that the exhausted and hungry gods gathered like flies over the offering. Suddenly they realized that man and the food he grew and the cattle he raised were essential. When at length Enlil arrived and saw the ark, he was enraged. But the logic of the situation and Enki's persuasion prevailed. Enlil made his peace with the remnants of mankind and took Atrahasis
in his craft up to the eternal abode of the gods. What was this catastrophe, predictable yet unavoidable? Our conclusion is that the events of the deluge or the flood relate to the Earth's last ice age and its catastrophic ending. Of the many theories advanced by the scientists, we're intrigued by the one suggested by Dr. John T. Holland of the University of Maine. He contended that the Antarctic ice sheet periodically breaks loose and slips into the sea, creating an abrupt and enormous tidal wave. Holland calculated that if only half the present ice sheet of Antarctica were to slip into the southern seas, the immense tidal wave that would follow would raise the level of all of the seas around the globe by some 60 feet. In 1964, A.T. Wilson of Victoria University in New Zealand offered the theory that ice ages ended abruptly in such slippages, not only in the Antarctic, but also in the Arctic. We feel that the various texts and facts gathered by us justify a conclusion that the deluge was the result of such a slippage in the Antarctic waters of billions of tons of ice, bringing an abrupt end to the last ice age. We know that the Nephilim associated the first governments and the first cities with zodiacal ages, giving the zodiacs the epithets of the various associated gods. The deluge, one text informs us, occurred in the age of the constellation Lion. If the deluge occurred in the age of the Lion, or sometime between 10,860 BC and 8,700 BC, then the date of the deluge falls well within our timetable. According to modern science, the last ice age ended abruptly in the southern hemisphere some 12 to 13,000 years ago, and in the northern hemisphere 1 to 2,000 years later. The deluge, a traumatic experience for mankind, was no less so for the gods, the Nephilim. The South African mines, the cities in Mesopotamia, the control center at Nippur, the spaceport at Sippar, all lay buried under water and mud. Hovering in their shuttlecraft above Earth, the Nephilim impatiently awaited the abatement of waters so that they could set foot again on solid ground. How were they going to survive henceforth with their cities and facilities gone and their manpower, mankind, totally destroyed? When the frightened, exhausted, and hungry groups of Nephilim finally landed on the peaks of the Mount of Salvation, they were clearly relieved to discover that man and beast alike had not perished completely. Even Enlil, at first enraged to discover that his aims had been partly frustrated, soon changed his mind. The deity's decision was a practical one. Faced with their own dire conditions, the Nephilim cast aside their inhibitions about man, rolled up their sleeves, and lost no time in imparting to man the arts of growing crops and cattle. Since survival, no doubt, depended on the speed with which agriculture and animal domestication could be developed to sustain the Nephilim and a rapidly multiplying mankind, the Nephilim applied their advanced scientific knowledge to the task. Many scientists who've studied the origins of agriculture have arrived at the conclusion that its discovery by mankind some 13,000 years ago was related to the neothermal climate that followed the end of the last ice age. Long before modern scholars, however, the Bible also related the beginnings of agriculture to the aftermath of the deluge. Sowing and harvesting were described in Genesis as divine gifts granted to Noah and his offspring as part of the post-diluvial covenant between deity and mankind. For as long as the earth's days shall be, there shall not cease sowing and harvesting, cold and warmth, summer and winter, day and night. Having been granted the knowledge of agriculture, Noah as a husbandman was first, and he planted a vineyard. He became the first post-diluvial farmer engaged in the deliberate, complicated task of planting. The Sumerian text, too, ascribed to the gods the granting to mankind of both agriculture and the domestication of animals. Tracing the beginnings of agriculture, modern scholars have found that it appeared first in the Near East, but not in the fertile and easily cultivated plains and valleys. Rather, agriculture began in the mountains skirting the low-lying plains in a semicircle. Why would farmers avoid the plains and limit their sowing and reaping to the more difficult mountainous terrain? The only plausible answer there is that the low-lying areas were not yet dry enough following the deluge. The Sumerian texts state that Enlil first spread cereals in the hill country, in the mountains, not in the plains, and he made cultivation possible in the mountains by keeping the floodwaters away. Scholars are unable to explain how the earliest grains were already uniform and highly specialized. There is no explanation for this botanogenetic miracle unless the process was not one of natural selection, but of artificial manipulation. The Sumerians knew the answer. The seeds, they said, were a gift sent to Earth by Anu from his celestial abode. Wheat, barley, and hemp were lowered to Earth from the 12th planet. Agriculture and the domestication of animals were gifts given to mankind by Enlil and Enki, respectively. It appears that the Nephilim, passing knowledge to man in measured doses, did so in intervals matching the periodic returns of the 12th planet to Earth's vicinity. The Nephilim, we are told, reached the conclusion that they needed an intermediary between themselves and the masses of humans. As a bridge between themselves as lords and mankind, they introduced kingship on Earth, appointing a human ruler that would assure mankind's service to the gods and channel the teachings and laws of the gods to the people. Texts state that the Nephilim retained the lordship over the lands and had mankind first rebuild the cities exactly where they had originally been. The first royal city of man, the Sumerian texts tell us, was Kish. The biblical Table of Nations listed Nimrod, the patriarch of the kingdoms at Uruk, Akkad, Babylon, and Assyria, as descended from Kish. It records the spread of mankind, its lands and kingships, as an outgrowth of the division of mankind into three branches following the deluge. Descended from and named after the three sons of Noah, these were the peoples of the lands of Shem, who inhabited Mesopotamia, and the Near Eastern lands, Ham, who inhabited Africa and parts of Arabia, and Japheth, the Indo-Europeans in Asia Minor, Iran, India, and Europe. These three broad groupings were undoubtedly three of the regions whose settlements were discussed by the great Anunnaki. Each of the three were assigned to one of the leading deities. One of these was, of course, Sumer itself, the region of the Semitic peoples, the place where man's first great civilization arose. The other two also became sites of flourishing civilizations around 3200 BC. About half of a millennium after the blooming of the Sumerian civilization, statehood, kingship, and civilization made their first appearance in the Nile Valley, leading in time to the great civilization of Egypt. Nothing was known until some 50 years ago about the first major Indo-European civilization. But by now, it's well established that an advanced civilization encompassing large cities, a developed agriculture, a flourishing trade, existed in the Indus Valley in ancient times. It came into being, scholars believe, some 1,000 years after the Sumerian civilization began. Ancient texts, as well as archaeological evidence, attest to the close cultural and economic links between these two river valley civilizations and the older Sumerian one. Moreover, both direct and circumstantial evidence has convinced most scholars that the civilizations of the Nile and the Indus not only were linked to, but were actually offspring of, the earlier civilization in Mesopotamia. The most imposing monuments of Egypt, the pyramids, have been found to be under a stone skin, simulations of the Mesopotamian ziggurats. And there is reason to believe that the ingenious architect who designed the plans for the Great Pyramids and supervised their construction was a Sumerian venerated as a god. The ancient Egyptian name for the land was the Ra's land, and their prehistoric memory was that a very great god came forth in the earliest times, found their land lying under water and mud. He undertook great works of reclamation, literally raising Egypt from under the waters. The legend neatly describes the low-lying valley of the Nile River in the aftermath of the flood. This olden god, it can be shown, was none other than Enki, the chief engineer of the Nephilim. Though little is known as yet regarding the Indus Valley civilizations, we do know that they too venerated the number 12 as the supreme divine number, that they depicted their gods as human-looking beings wearing horned headdresses, and that they revered the symbol of the cross, the sign of the 12th planet. If these two civilizations were of Sumerian origin, why are their written languages different? The scientific answer is that the languages are not different. This was recognized in early 1852 when the Reverend Charles Foster ably demonstrated that all of the ancient languages then deciphered, including early Chinese and other Far Eastern languages, stemmed from one primeval source, thereafter shown to be Sumerian. So we have a single written language that for some reason was differentiated into three tongues.
Mesopotamian, Egyptian, and Indo-European. Such a differentiation could have occurred by itself over time, distance, and geographical separation, yet the Sumerian texts claim that it occurred as the result of a deliberate decision of the gods, once again initiated by Enlil. Fearing evidently a human race unified in culture and purpose, the Nephilim adopted an imperial policy, divide and rule. For while mankind reached cultural levels that included even airborne efforts, the Nephilim themselves were a declining lot. By the 3rd millennium B.C., children and grandchildren, to say nothing of humans of divine parentage, were crowding the great olden gods. The bitter rivalry between Enlil and Enki was inherited by their principal sons, and fierce struggles for supremacy ensued. As time went on, the gods became overlords, each jealously guarding the territory, industry, or profession over which he had been given dominion. Human kings were the intermediaries between the gods and the growing and spreading humanity. The claims of ancient kings that they went to war, or conquered new lands, or subjugated distant peoples on the command of my God should not be taken lightly. Text after text makes it clear that this was literally so. The gods retained the powers of conducting foreign affairs. Accordingly, they had a final say in matters of war and peace. With the proliferation of peoples, states, cities, and villages, it became necessary to find ways to remind the people who their particular overlord or lofty one was. The solution was to establish many places of worship and to put up in each of them the symbol and likeness of the correct gods. The age of paganism began. Following the deluge, the Sumerian texts inform us the Nephilim held lengthy councils regarding the future of gods and man on earth. As a result of these deliberations, they created four regions. Three of them, Mesopotamia, the Nile Valley, and the Indus Valley, were settled by man. The fourth region was holy, dedicated to the gods alone. It was a pure land, an area that could be approached only with authorization. Trespassing could lead to a quick death by awesome weapons wielded by fierce guards. The land or region was named Tilmun, literally the place of the missiles. It was the restricted area where the Nephilim had reestablished their space base after the one at Sippar had been wiped out by the deluge. Ancient heroes like Gilgamesh strove to reach this land of the living to be carried by a Shem to the heavenly abode of the gods. Ancient tales, even recorded history, recall the ceaseless efforts of man to reach the land, find the plant of life, gain eternal bliss among the gods of heaven and earth. This yearning is central to all the religions whose roots lie deep in Sumer, the hope that justice and righteousness pursued on earth will be followed by an afterlife in some heavenly divine abode. But where was this elusive land of the divine connection? The question can be answered. The clues are there. But beyond it loom other questions. Have the Nephilim been encountered since? What will happen when they are encountered again? And if the Nephilim were the gods who created man on earth, did evolution alone, on the 12th planet, create the Nephilim?